Blog Talk Radio.
Greetings, this is Blake the Eccentric, and I want to invite you to check out my new show on Freedomizer Radio, The Eccentric Perspective. It's sort of a red pill, blue pill, going down the rabbit hole kind of show, featuring outside-the-box politics, philosophy, and gonzo journalism. But be warned, with knowledge comes responsibility, and you might not see the world the same way again. As I will attempt to open your mind, speak to your common sense, and challenge your critical thinking skills. So please join me Monday, Wednesday, and Thursday from noon to 1:30 Pacific Time. Once again, that's Eccentric Perspective, only on Freedomizer Radio. All right, greetings and welcome. It is Thursday, July 19th of 2012. I am Blake the Eccentric. This is the Eccentric Perspective on Freedomizer Radio, and I will be here for the next hour and a half covering the latest news and current events. Number to call in, 347-324-3704. We'll just open it wide open today. Actually, the initial plan here is to cover the news for the next half an hour, and I'm expecting to be joined by a guest. We'll go from there. We're going to be talking about the Oath Keepers. I'm going to have Deborah Swan, if all things go according to plan. And we're going to be I heard a very compelling story about the Oath Keepers and a controversial member named Charles Dyer, who's been having some issues with the establishment. So it's a very interesting story. You might want to stick around for that. We'll discuss. Guys, this is kind of news to me. I've been kind of new to it from a couple of days ago, but wow. Very, very compelling story. So I'm excited to hear about this. So anyway, without further ado, I'm going to jump to, it's actually a good timing anyway, because this is really I hate to use the cliche slow news day, but really isn't anything too bombshell today. So it'll be good to hear from this guest coming up in about 27 minutes. Anywho, so just to give you an idea on the Drudge Report headlines today, number one, we've got, this is the headline currently right now, is the USDA is partnering with Mexico to boost food stamp participation. So they're, what, boosting more, I don't know if you want to call it welfare or I don't know if that's necessarily the direction, as it shows you the direction we're going in. I don't even know. So the this is out of the Daily Caller here. We've got the Mexican government has been working with the United States Department of Agriculture to increase participation in the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program, or SNAP, or food stamps. So USDA has an agreement with Mexico to promote American food assistance programs, including food stamps, among Mexican Americans, Mexican nationals, and migrant communities in America. So the USDA and the government of Mexico have entered into a partnership to help educate eligible Mexican nationals living in the United States about available nutrition assistance, the USDA explains in a brief paragraph on their, quote, Reaching Low-Income Hispanics with Nutrition Assistance webpage. Mexico will help disseminate this information through its embassy and network of approximately 50 consular offices. So I don't know. They're making it sound like it's a good thing to have more people surviving on the government dole. I don't know. I don't really see that. But like I said, it's slow news day, and I'm just covering the news. So, anywho, like I said, moving on. What else do we have? The other headline I picked up about that just changed from about a half an hour ago and is about weekly claims post rebound. This is the job claims. So the job market is still I don't know, I say in the toilet, they say still in the doldrums. The number of Americans filing new claims for unemployment benefits rebounded last week, pushing them back to levels consistent with modest job growth after a seasonal quirk caused a sharp drop the prior period. So I won't bore you with all these numbers, but, the unemployment benefits is increasing, and of course you've got more people on Social Security and disability. So it's getting crazy, but I'm going to get to a couple of articles here by Michael Snyder coming up. Well, this is kind of the half-an-hour news blitz, like I've said, so I'll tie that together just to give you an idea of how bad things are getting. He's always got some good articles there. So what else do we have going on today? And like I said, you know, phones are open for another 25 minutes. Perhaps I've missed something. Wow, I seem to have some issues here. I got my phones beeping. I don't know what to get this little beeping in my ear. I don't know what's going on here. And now my seem to be having all kinds of technical issues. So we'll see how this develops. I don't know if my the continued craziness of covering the alternative media in this pivotal year in human history, 2012. It just gets crazier every day. Except, well, you know, outside of the fact that it's a slow news day today, it's always something exciting. Anywho, like I said, I've got the number to call in. Be happy to hear from you, whatever you want to discuss here. And like I said, stick around for the guests and the big interview I've got coming up in T-minus 23 minutes. And definitely want to hear that out. So what else do we have? We had George Zimmerman made his first big public appearance, big interview on with Hannity, of all people. So I guess giving his version of what happened. There's a couple of interesting video clips here. I'm going to throw that on the board in case anybody hasn't seen. Anywho, pop that up. I don't even know really what to cover on that. Actually, you know what? Why don't I talk to Larry here? I know he's on the phone. Larry, what's up, brother?
More beeps. After you see how the beeps were driving you crazy, I'd help.
Dude, I don't know what's going on. I got all these, I got beeps on my phone. It's driving me nuts. Like it's like the battery's out or something. But it's been on a charger all night, so I don't know. Yeah.
I'm gonna have to educate you, son. It's not I got. It's I have or we have. Not we
all right.
Got.
On what?
Just thought I'd let you know. Okay. While the deliberate dumbing down of America is happening, I'm having a deliberate intensification of educating America. How's that? Hello? You there? What happened? Well, crap. What happened? Yeah, I can barely hear you.
I'm acting goofy. Looks like I don't know if my virus stuff on my computer is going wacky. You know, just talking to the guest I've got coming up, and she was warning me about there's going to be, you know, weird things happening with phones and stuff like that. It's a very controversial issue, I guess.
The NSA does not want us to be able to communicate with each other without them able to listen in and cut us off if we say anything they do not like.
Yeah, so now I guess my audio is going to suffer because I'm on the speakerphone now, but if not, I'll call in on my cell phone, whatever it takes. I don't know if this is a coincidence.
When that happens.
But yes, and then all of a sudden my computer's having issues, all of a sudden my virus stuff goes under, I don't know, but whatever it takes, we'll just bring the issue forward. I'm not saying it could be a coincidence, I don't know.
It could be. I used to, when my computer was plugged in and up and running, I used to have problems from time to time. And then I got smart and I got away from Norton and McAfee antivirus stuff. And I went, for a long time, I had PC Tools because they were really good.
Yeah, I don't know what to make of that. It could be a coincidence, but like I said, I don't know what was going on with my phone. I've been having that, you know, this earpiece
you have to watch for web roots. I had some really good anti-web root stuff in my computer too. I went and looked up all the viruses and said, okay, who gets rid of what? And so I just had a bunch of different stuff. I never had anything automatic turn on. Always everything had to be manually turned on to do anything. That way nothing ever was in conflict with the other.
Yeah.
And it worked better that way. And if I ever did get any kind of weird key logger or anything like that, my computer would say, we have a problem. I'm like, okay, let's get rid of it. And that was it. You have to watch out for all those Trojans. Man.
Things have been pretty solid, but now I'm just on the landline and the speakerphone, so the only thing that's going to my audio.
I learned the hard way. I had one of the first original computers with a AMD Athlon high performance core, you know, thing, whatever. Yeah, CPU, that's what I was thinking of. Anyway, I lost because due to some virus and other crap. I lost my hard drive. It crashed totally. Couldn't even bring it back up. And I learned the hard way on that. And I said, screw McAfee, because that's what I had at the time. They suck.
Yeah.
And I tried Norton, and I was getting viruses and all this crap. And I was like, oh, man, screw this. And you know what I was getting that from? Stupid game sites.
Yeah, you got to be careful on all that stuff, so...
But the sites were supposed to be legitimate, like Game Spy or some shit like that. I don't remember.
Yeah.
When you hit,
I hear.
You. When
you, forums,
they were supposed to be legitimate,
stuff,
and they were the worst on having viruses, but and spyware. I hated that. Spyware was like really bad at those gaming sites. I wound up just going to the store and. And yes, once upon a time, I got into certain games. Like, I had Medal of Honor. No, I didn't get into that. I had the World War II games. I had a flight simulator for an F-14 Tomcat. Flight simulator.
Yeah,
I still have those. Flight
Good
simulator
stuff.
For an F-18. Check this out, man. When you get time, listen to Alex Jones. He had Joe Farah on, which you really ought to have on sometime with you and Brian. And, I can't remember. Bob something. I forget. He has a gun store, hardware store.
Bob. I can listen later.
Yeah. But it was a good show. I mean, the first hour and a half or so, you know, Alex ranted and all that kind of stuff. But later he kind of calmed down.
Awesome.
Is that who it was?
Businessman, North American researcher, union researcher, and...
He's big time anti-UN, man. Anti-New World Order. Did some excellent research and come up with some stuff I didn't even know about. So, you know, because I forgot about Article 29 and the UN agenda.
I'll be listening to the show later. Yeah. I was curious.
Very good education. Joe Farah is excellent, too. I like Joe Farah. Although I disagree with him on the fact that Muslims are doing this all on their own. If it wasn't for the CIA and the British SAS and MI6, they wouldn't be able to do what they do. But that's another story. So who do you have coming on?
It's going to be Deborah Swan, and she's going to be talking about a controversial oath keeper named Charles Dyer, who I just kind of heard about.
I know Charles. He's only at the most about 70 miles north of where my farm is. I've talked to him before.
Oh, okay, yeah.
He got busted on supposedly having a 40-millimeter grenade launcher, got thrown out of court, or he was found not guilty, let me put it that way. And
yeah.
Then his ex accused him of child molestation, which was bullshit, but that's another matter. But
yeah.
After that, I never really talked to him because, you know, we agreed that things were getting too hot for him, and it was, like, time for him to, like, kind of fall back and regroup because, you know, everybody was making a big deal about him being a patriot and an oath keeper, and he was Marine Recon, dude.
Yeah.
So what's he done wrong now, supposedly?
Oh, I'll have to stick around about 15 more minutes. We'll be able to go through the whole story. It's it's all new to me, so I was
curious.
Yeah,
there was a guy on YouTube that helped snitch on him. I went rounds with this one guy, and I told a little crazy-ass bitch. I said, you're
Rick
a panty waist. And he said, I spelled panty waist with a W-A-I-S-T-E, right? And and he said, it's spelled W-A-S-T-E. I said, you know what? You're right, because you are trash. But anyway, because, you know, he didn't understand it. But the guy, if I had ever saw him, it's Mike something. I can't remember his last name. But, yeah, there was some stuff going on. He got set up and knocked down like a bowling pin and set back up again.
That's what the interview is going to be about, yeah.
Yeah, his ex-wife framed him. It was BS. Even the cops said it was BS. She had to go to Oklahoma City to another county to get a prosecutor that would take the case. That's New World Order. She had to get out of a good area. Okay? That's how set up he was. But all that is, you know, yeah, I'll listen and see what's up and all that. Because I haven't talked to Chuck in a long time. Well, I should say Sergeant Charles Dyer, U.S. Marine. Recon, non-active.
Right.
But anyway, sorry, man. It's like my family's like, you know, traditional military anyway.
But no, he's
story.
From he's like a multi-generational military family as well.
Yeah, I know. That's why we hit it off because I told him, I said, man, my old man was Marine, and in Korea, and then he was a corpsman for the Navy because they were short of corpsmen, and they said, hey, you have intelligent brain, we can use your kind of aptitude, because he was patching up his own soldiers in Korea, and, you know, that was bad news up there anyway. But anyway, so they're like, okay, fine. So he was both Marine and a corpsman. He kept his Marine status and wound up being a corpsman for the Navy at the same time. Go figure on that one. So he was a Marine and Navy at the same time. But anyway, so, you know, he and I got along. And he was a prepper, and this is years ago and stuff. And we talked about a lot of different stuff about, you know, helping people train and, you know, what's coming down the pike and what's good to have and what's not good to have and, you know, what works and what doesn't, all that kind of crap. And, you know, he agreed with me, small bullet, small results, big bullet, a lot better results. But so this girl coming on, she knows Charles?
Yeah, she has a firsthand account of everything going on, but I just kind of got.
And what's her name?
Deborah Swan.
I wonder if she's a tattooed chick that I used to talk to there once in a blue moon.
Yeah,
I forget.
Don't know.
I can't remember. I met some people there that were in support of Charles way back, and I don't remember all the names. It's been so long ago, and I've gone 600,000 miles down the road since then. They figure, you know, I don't know, I run about 150,000 miles a year or so. But anyway, yeah, just, you know, I'll be listening. And
yeah,
if I have anything to say, I'll cue myself in and say, what's up? What's happening? Semper Fi. And if you're listening, Charles, if you're listening, old friend, Semper Fi to you, my friend. One of these days I'll get a smartphone. I'll get back in touch with you. But anyway. Go ahead, do your thing, my friend.
No, I'm glad you've heard of him. Yeah, well, about 10 more minutes, Larry, so cool.
All right, man. Okay.
All right, dude.
Later,
have a
dude.
Good one.
Bye.
All right, and there goes Larry. So I got another 10 minutes for break, so I guess it should be pretty easy to do a news blitz. I didn't even really want to get into the Trayvon Martin or anything. It's just, yeah, this is how slow the news day is today, but certainly one of the biggest issues of the year. It didn't need to be. It's a horrible tragedy, but I'm not going to backtrack and get into all that right now. Save that for another day, especially when the trial gets up, because I think it's, well, anyway, like I said, I don't want to get sidetracked. I got a lot of other issues to get to. Got Russia and China are vetoing sanctions on Syria. Yeah, Russia and China vetoed a new UN Security Council resolution Thursday that would have imposed new sanctions on the Syrian regime. Western countries have been pushing for a resolution that threatens sanctions against the regime of President Bashar al-Assad if government forces don't stop attacks. And notice how you see Western countries. Western countries have been pushing for a resolution. And China and Russia, who are right freaking next to Syria, are vetoing it. Why don't we let them deal with their own little domestic problem? We have no business getting involved in this. No matter how, you know, I'm sure al-Assad is a bad character, but you know what? Just one of many, and maybe it's time for us to, you know, stop getting involved in every little affair, especially with the UN, who is not, and I don't like what they're doing here. I don't like this continued UN Agenda 21. They want to tell us how to live. They want to tell us how to, you know, to do our gun control. I mean, this is, of course, the small arms treaty that they're trying to push through right now. They need to kind of butt out of everybody's way here. We've got a lot of bad people, but you know what? We can't just sit there and police everything. Time to let the people that are on that side of the country, you know, that are a little bit more probably, you know, share borders or are in that region to handle their own affairs without everybody else getting involved in their business. With the way we handled Libya and with the, you know, the horrible dictatorship we had and let go in Egypt and all the other, you know, the fake WMDs and Iraq, you know, I think we have reason to suspect that maybe our foreign policy isn't that great and, you know, well, whatever. Anywho, and we don't want to see this leading to World War III. And Obama also, I guess, called Putin. I don't know if he just, yeah, he called Russian President Vladimir Putin, Assad's main international supporter, after a Damascus bomb blast killed Syria's defense minister and Assad's brother-in-law, throwing the 16-month-old rebellion onto an unpredictable new path. So, I don't know. Just more craziness. I'm no expert in Syria, but I don't like these developments. I'd just like to see the world be a little bit better place. I don't know how we're going to – this is just going to be one of the craziest years, like I said, in human history. We will see. So let's see, about another 5 more minutes to blast through the news here before I get to the guest. And here's another crazy story. TSA let 25 illegal aliens attend flight school owned by an illegal alien. So the TSA approved flight training for 25 illegal aliens at a Boston-area flight school that was owned by yet another illegal alien, according to the Government Accountability Office. So does that just get crazy? And, of course, so, you know, after, you know, 9/11 and you had all these hijackers that were trained at U.S. base, this is just – everything just continues to get crazier. And like I said, I don't have enough time to, you know, get into all the details and such. Unfortunately, we don't have a lot of time. Had to get into a whole 9/11 issue. That's another story altogether. So, and I know there's a, let me just post this article, because that, the one I got off of there, I just read, was on the Drudge Report, and I've got a Kurt Nimmo article, speaking of InfoWars, and I will post that on the board. Okay. That's certainly interesting. Yeah, for somebody, for a company that you think that is, like, you know, obsessed with you know, keeping us safe from you know, terrorists or whatever, and you're making, you know, letting all these illegal aliens have a little bit a little too close for comfort here. Anyway, sorry if I'm not articulating everything. I'm in the nature of time here. But what else do I have here? A woman pulls a gun to prevent smart meter installation. It's another one out of InfoWars. That was amusing in a way. What else do we got? Of course, I was talking about the economy here and a couple of Michael Snyder articles. Got bankers declare U.S. and Europe conquered. We've got here Mark of the Beast. FBI wants a tattoo database. Sorry, buzzing through the headlines. I don't even know where to start here. So we got 20 signs that point to the exact same thing, and can you guess what that is? And that is the U.S. economy is in a massive amount of trouble. There aren't enough jobs. There isn't enough money to go around. Business activity is slowing down again. Household wealth has been falling. Food prices have been rising, and many state and local governments all over the country are flat broke and are drowning in debt. So the federal government has been rolling up unprecedented amounts of debt in an attempt to keep things going, but everyone knows that kind of borrowing is simply unsustainable. So where do we go from here? So this is one of these articles out of from Michael Snyder in the Economic Collapse blog, and I'm going to throw that on the board. I might even just jump to commercial. Like I said, cover these into too much detail, and I'm excited to get to this guest here. And we've got all, there's another article by Michael Snyder here. It's why are so many bad things happening to America? We're just going over these heat and the drought, the wildfires, tornadoes. We got Fukushima, economic collapse, we've got poverty explosions, we got the death of American cities. Increases in crimes, gang violence, war. It's sort of like we got anxiety epidemics, obesity epidemics, child abuse epidemics, teen pregnancy, divorce, $16 trillion national debt, political nightmare. Sort of like I've used the reference, the new fall of Rome or what have you. I don't know. Just things seem to be crumbling. Rome is burning away. I'm going to post that on the board as well. Wow. Okay. So why don't I'm just going to leave those there. I am going to jump to commercial, and then I'm going to be back awaiting the guest here. Let me get too many things going on here. And I got too many technical problems. Now I'm talking on my landline here. Everything's just falling apart. But let's see. Give me 2 minutes. I am going to reset and recharge, and I'm going to be back on the other side with our guest. Hopefully, Deborah Swan will be joining us. This is a very compelling story about Charles Dyer and the Oath Keepers. And all kinds of craziness. So stick around 2 more minutes. I'll be back on the other side. Blake the Eccentric, the Eccentric Perspective on Freedomizer Radio.
You know the Constitution like the back of your hand. You've read books, listened to podcasts, attended lectures, surfed websites, and watched videos. You've made liberty your life's goal. But something seems to be missing. Stickers from LibertyStickers.com. Exercise your freedom of speech with the world's most dangerous bumper stickers. That's LibertyStickers.com. But wait. There's more. You can buy Liberty stickers wholesale. Get them for 99 cents each when you put 100 or more in your shopping cart in any combination. Sell them or give them away. They're great for gun shows, flea markets, fairs, outreach, and more. Earn extra money, promote freedom, and spread the word. Need custom stickers, labels, or decals for your organization or business? Liberty Stickers makes them. Go to LibertyStickers.com to order or call 877-873-9626. LibertyStickers.com, the world's most dangerous stickers.
Wow. Hey folks, Valerie Sergeant Martin here, rebel agitator, Republican renegade, and host of the Valerie Sergeant Martin Show. Twice weekly, I bring you guests who represent the best and brightest of the liberty movement, including best-selling authors, candidates, and legislators, and everyday activists, all patriots actively involved in taking back control of our government, putting power in the hands of the people where it belongs. We also talk economics, finance, international markets, and monetary policy. Anything and everything to do with free markets and capitalism. So friend me on Facebook, follow me on Twitter, and join me Sundays 4 to 6 p.m. Eastern and Thursdays 8 to 9 p.m. Eastern for the Valerie Sergeant Martin Show. And remember, extremism in defense of liberty is no vice.
Hey, Freedomist, join me, Proof Negative, weeknights, 9 p.m. to midnight Eastern, 6 p.m. to 9 p.m. Pacific, as we fight the New World Order together, right here on Freedomizer Radio, your exclusive home of the Proof Negative Show.
Please learn more about Freedomizer Radio by going to freedomizerradio.com and also Facebook us right at freedomizerradio.com. Catch you there.
All right, I am back. Blake, the eccentric perspective on Freedomizer Radio. And so, like I said, we're about to get to the interview here. I think I have Deb on hold right now. So I just wanted to go over the Oath Keepers here. Actually, I'm going to bring her up right now. We can go over this here. Hey, Deborah, are you there?
Hi. Yes, I'm here. Hi, how are you doing?
Hey, Deborah, good to hear from you.
Thanks.
So, quite the compelling story. I know we were talking a little bit ago about issues with phones and stuff like that. My phone actually went out, so I'm on a different phone as well, and computer snafus, all kinds of strange stuff. So, can you tell me real quick, how are you affiliated with the Oath Keepers?
Well, I'm not really affiliated with them directly anymore. Okay. I am a supporter of Oath Keepers, but they pretty much have not, you know, been involved with the Charles Dyer situation since the very beginning. So, but I used to be a member of Oath Keepers, and I do support the Oath Keepers, I do. But they haven't been directly involved with any of this for Charles.
Okay, and so let me just give, I'm just going to say for people that maybe aren't familiar with Oath Keepers, and I am not an Oath Keeper, but I am 100% behind them. And what they basically do is they take, you know, people take an oath to the Constitution, military and law enforcement, and just to sum it up, where I'll say, like, say, if I wanted to make an oath, I would say, like, I, Blake Wally, do solemnly swear that I will support and defend the Constitution of the United States of America against all enemies, foreign and domestic. And I think a lot of people tend to overlook the domestic. They never seem to think that that there's a domestic threat like that could never happen. I think people really got to underestimate that because people tend to, you know, believe their own government or whatever, and they can kind of get into a position where they can follow, you know, unlawful orders. And you look at some of the foreign wars we got going on, or just some of our bad foreign policy, and people that are following orders and doing the wrong things because they think maybe they're doing the right thing or whatever. And then we look at people like look at, say, you know, Nazi Germany. I hate to use an extreme example, but you know, they, what were they doing? Following orders. Then we look at just the recent example, of course, Katrina, when you know, people are following orders to do, you know, gun grabs and do unlawful things. So what Oath Keepers does is it gets, it has 10 orders they will not obey, and it's very important. I suggest everybody in law enforcement or military or anything to go check out Oath Keepers and Stuart Rhodes, because these are basic, these are, seem to be basic common sense things that everybody should follow, and that's not to they will not obey orders to disarm the American people. They will not obey orders to conduct warrantless searches of American people. They will not obey orders to detain American citizens as unlawful enemy combatants, like NDAA. They will not obey orders to impose martial law. They will not obey orders to invade or subjugate any state that asserts its sovereignty. They will not obey any order to blockade American cities or turn them into concentration camps. They will not obey any order to force American citizens to, detention camps under any pretext. They will not obey orders to assist or support the use of foreign troops on U.S. soil against the American people to keep the peace or to maintain control. And they will not obey orders to confiscate the property of American people, including food and supplies. And lastly, they will not obey orders which infringe on the right of the people to free speech, to peaceably assemble, or to petition their government for a redress of grievances. So I think that's very important, obviously, to keep our American way of life. So, Deborah?
And all those things that you listed are, you know, like you said, are very important, and that is exactly what Charles Dyer's stance was. That's why he, you know, was a big part of Oath Keepers in the very beginning, is he was, you know, one of the few men who actually went around and he spoke at a lot of tea parties for Stuart Rhodes. He was, you know, basically a spokesperson for Oath Keepers. And he would have, you know, a gathering of thousands of people reaffirm the oath that they took and raise their hand. And so he kind of led those, you know, former and current military or police officers at these gatherings to reaffirm their oath of everything you just stated. So that was his place in all this. And he started to make YouTube videos about, you know, the oath and the Constitution, and very outspoken about what was happening. And the Oath Keepers, pretty much in my mind, it kind of helps us when people call us conspiracy theorists and how we're, you know, we're crazy. What the Oath Keepers, I think, does is it verifies that there's some sort of threat out there, or these, you know, active and former, you know, police officers would not even have these type of, you know, concerns. And so these 10 unlawful orders, that Oath Keepers promises they're not going to follow, shows us that there's a threat, obviously, that one day this could actually, you know, come down.
Yeah, all they have to do is look right at Katrina. I mean, what happened when things got sour? All of a sudden, the police went out and grabbed everybody's guns. So it was a bad thing, and they left them defenseless. There was looters abound, and all kinds of bad things happened during that crisis. So these things could happen again, and it comes from a lot of, you know, naive people in law enforcement or military that just obey any orders. I mean, it's got to be kind of scary to be in that position. But I can't picture anybody having an issue with any of those 10 things that I said. I mean, those are very
exactly.
Basic common sense that every American, this is America, that's what we want, we expect out of our law enforcement. So,
right, and they take an oath of office every time any officer or any public servant out there, you know, is allowed to have their gun or their badge or the robe or whatever position that they're filling. They take an oath to the people, to all of us, to promise that they will uphold our constitutional rights and not overstep or violate them. So when police officers are out there overstepping their rights or their positions of authority, it's up to we, the people, to hold them accountable, and a lot of people don't even do that. So it's really concerning to me. Accountability
right.
is very important.
So, with that being said, so where, what would you like to tell the, like, I just talked to, you know, speaking of, you know, Oath Keepers and, you know, NDAA, I was on a conference call last Monday on the show, and we talked to Stuart Rhodes, we talked to Dan Johnson from Panda, and I talked to Dan off the air. And he was kind of giving me a little background on Charles Dyer. I said I hadn't heard of him. I knew, you know, Stuart Rhodes and the Oath Keepers. And so I said, you know, I'd be interested in, you know, hearing this story. And then he gave you my number, and you got in contact with me, and I wanted to hear this story, but I don't have much of a background of it, so I'm curious to hear.
Well, it's a very crazy story, and it's all real. And I guess I could start where I got involved in this. And right before I got involved, you know, Charles Dyer, his handle is July 4 Patriot. A lot of people know him on YouTube under that handle, J4P or July 4 Patriot. So he has a YouTube channel, and you can go and check it out. He's got a lot of videos that he started putting out there after he got back from serving in Iraq. He's an 8-year you know, veteran. He served 8 years with the Marines, and he started to become very concerned and outspoken. And he was with the Oath Keepers in the very beginning, and Stuart Rhodes actually asked him if he would be the liaison for the Oath Keepers for the military members that would join. And at first, Charles was okay with it, but then he started getting more into the more the militia tone, the constitutional militia, the Second Amendment kind of, you know, areas of where he wanted to focus some of his direction on and informing and trying to help, you know, educate people by what's going on. So he started steering towards more that direction. And so that was a little bit of an issue with Oath Keepers because, you know, Oath Keepers was not about the militia part of it. They're trying to help inspire everyone to keep their oaths, all law enforcement. So the training part of it was a concern. So they both agreed, Stuart and Charles, that Charles would just be a spokesperson for Oath Keepers. And so he could still go about what he was wanting to get into, but he was not a actual, you know, he's denied the position that Stuart offered him as a liaison. So that's where the whole thing with Oath Keepers started. Then Charles, you know, was doing his traveling and speaking at tea parties, and I guess somebody had heard his message and didn't care for it because he was very much pro-Second Amendment, not terroristic kind of, you know, threats, but I guess to the government, the way that things are going, it could be actually interpreted as some sort of threat against the government. I don't think it was. It's just constitutional kind of, you know, beliefs. And he started to have these great videos on YouTube, and all of a sudden, out of the blue, his ex-wife was somehow she decided to, very vindictive woman, by the way, she decided to put these false charges of sexually raping his daughter against him. And she has a history also of doing things like this in the past. I mean, she called on Charles before his commander and lied and said that he was, you know, physically beating him and her and her daughter, and he was thrown in the brig for 2 weeks. He ended up getting out and all the charges were dropped, but there is a history of vindictiveness with the ex-wife. So she's filed these charges against Charles, and he's innocent of them, and he started fighting these charges, went to trial, had all the proof you could imagine to show he did not do this horrible act against his daughter. And unfortunately, I believe, and there's a lot of proof that the ex-wife has been compromised. She was most likely told to, you know, do this against Charles, basically, and because there's absolutely no evidence to show that he did this crime. And I personally had, you know, you always kind of wonder if this is true or not true, but after I heard from his first trial how bad it went, he had a guilty verdict, and then on the way into the courtroom, one jury member changed their vote to not guilty. So that swung the entire situation into a mistrial. And so that's when I got involved at that point.
Ah, okay. Yeah, no. So let's maybe start maybe from the beginning. So how did everything just kind of exactly what happened? I find it hard to believe. Now, there's one issue that I did have with Charles Dyer. Now, he's a very, he seems like a very smart, well-spoken guy. I know there is a little bit of an issue with some of the YouTube, but I would say an easy target to go after, just because of some of the, sometimes he would wear like a mask, and I think that would kind of, you know, rub people the wrong way.
I don't care for the mask either, but I think that was possibly bad advice given to him from some people that did not have his best interest in mind. You know, he was pretty impressionable at that point, and he was just trying to hide his identity.
He seemed like a guy who was fired up about, you know, things like Katrina and stuff like that. And, he could have been led astray by the wrong people. Like I said, I don't know a lot about him. That's why I was happy to have you on to hear this story, not, you know, just for me and for everybody out there. It's certainly, I found it very compelling. And you said, there was some crazy charges, like they would against a 7-year rape charges against his 7-year-old daughter. I mean, that just sounds incredibly far fetched. Like, who would? It doesn't make any sense. Yeah.
Well, it doesn't make any sense. It doesn't make any sense, and there's no proof. And so when I went out to visit Charles after I heard about how bad the first trial went, you know, because Charles, he was ready to go in there to show his defense. He has a beautiful defense. He had, you know, he felt really strong and confident with his system, and he was going to go in there in front of a jury of his peers and show his proof and be found not guilty. So he was ready to go in there. And then when he went into his first trial, the entire thing was corrupt. His attorney was not doing anything like he was supposed to, was not objecting to all these crazy things that the district attorney was doing during the courtroom. I'm talking like they totally lied to the jury about the truth on what the DNA forensic report says about the about Charles. There was nothing. There was no DNA found on any crime scenes at all. And the district attorney's assistant got up in front of the jury as one of her final closing statements and lied and said flat out that there was, that Charles Dyer's DNA was found with a possible second-rate victim, and just kind of left the whole statement kind of hanging, thinking and implying that there was another possible child that he's violated. And it wasn't even the sperm DNA. She was talking about the skin cell DNA, which is a totally different kind of DNA that everybody leaves wherever you go. I mean, skin, you know, sheds all the time.
Yeah.
So the manipulating of the evidence and the playing off the ignorance of the jury, because these scientific reports are not the easiest things to read, you know, and his attorney did not get up and object, just let that whole statement, you know, hang out there for the jury, and so he ended up getting a guilty verdict. So,
all right, so let's start from the go ahead.
No, go ahead. You're fine.
Okay. I'd like to start from the beginning. So what exactly, if you could kind of give us maybe a timeline. So Charles Dyer, he's kind of a spokesperson of sorts, and he's recruiting people. He's informing people about the Oath Keepers, getting people to take their oath or whatever. He's making some YouTube videos, getting out there. And then what happens? How does this take an ugly turn?
Honestly, I don't know the exact dates. I'm not that.
Don't worry about the dates, but just the events and the timeline.
Well, that's pretty much how it happened. You know, during all this, he just got home. I think from serving over in Iraq, he got home. I believe it was like Christmas holiday. Don't hold me to these.
No, don't worry. We're just getting a rough idea of what happened, like event by event. Like let's go through all the significant events here that led to. You know, like I said, everything seemed to be going well. He's recruiting some people and making YouTube videos. Everything's cool. And then all of a sudden, what happens?
Well, that's pretty much how it happened. I mean, I said, personally, I didn't really start getting involved in all the details. And, you know, you hear this rumor out there about Charles Dyer, you know, molestation charges are filed. Just crazy. It makes you stop and go, what? You know, how
okay.
that
okay. So that
and
was
so
it. So it just, yeah. So everything
kind of
was,
out of the,
everything... Okay, sorry. Sorry, we keep trying to talk over each other. I'm sorry about that. So so everything's cool, and all of a sudden, like, boom, there's a bombshell, like, news headline, like, this Charles Dyer is, okay. So he gets in trouble.
Right. In my life, that's how it happened for me, because I heard this rumor. I didn't really pay a whole lot of attention to it because, you know, to me, Charles Dyer was a poster boy, great, you know, patriot kind of person. You just don't really think it's going to actually stick, you know, and so I wasn't really, the whole pre-trial stuff, the details of all that, because I never believed it from the beginning, but then when I heard the results of the first trial, that he was found barely by the skin of his teeth, he was, you know, one person finally changed their vote, that got me very interested in wanting to find out why. So I actually went to Oklahoma. I was on my way to Oklahoma to do some family research on some land. And so on my way into Oklahoma, you know, I'd been talking with Charles, and I asked if I could stop by and say hello and talk with him and just see what happened. And when I went there, you know, I met him in person. His house was very quiet. There was nobody really doing anything. He was by himself. At that point, his girlfriend was forced to leave the state of Oklahoma with her daughter. They had already that summer before I got there, they had taken, when I say they, the sheriff of his county, they tricked him, and they were able to get the daughter away from the girlfriend. They kidnapped the child, basically, for like 30 days. So his girlfriend could not have their daughter around. They didn't even know where she was. The state took the daughter. And so they were trying to fight to get the daughter back. Finally, the girlfriend, Charles' girlfriend, had to sign a paper saying that she agrees not to ever come back to Oklahoma and be around Charles and never have her daughter around Charles ever again. And he hasn't even been convicted yet. So that was a very big deal. They escorted the girlfriend and the child over state lines, and they had to leave. And so the girlfriend moved away. So when I met Charles, he was very alone, you know, very, you know.
Okay, so how long was he divorced? Who's the mother of his daughter? So he's making his youth.
Her name
okay,
is
what's
Valerie. Valerie
okay, and
name.
Then okay, and then how long were they separated before these charges came out?
For a while. I mean, and one interesting thing about the details on the wife and the new girlfriend is they used to be best friends. So you can see a definite motive. Yeah, big-time motive right there. I don't know the exact time frame, honestly, how long they were apart before these charges started, but Mandy, the girlfriend, and Charles and their daughters, they had a whole life together. You know, they had a they were living together. So it had been, you know, I want to say quite some time. You know, so,
okay, so they've separated or divorced or whatever. He's got maybe they got joint custody of this little girl. He's got his new girlfriend, and they're just having their life. And all of a sudden, this bombshell
right.
story comes out that he raped his daughter, his own
right.
daughter. He's got a girlfriend, and he's supposedly rapes his little 7-year-old daughter. Like that's just beyond belief, especially when you hear the guy speak. Whoops, sorry.
There was never an investigation. What got me hung up, I mean, my main highlight for this situation when I stepped in to find out what happened was when he told me about that there's never been an investigation on his side. Like, the charges were made by the ex-wife. She took the child to, I guess, the sheriff's department in that area in Stevens County. They turned her away. They said there's nothing that they can do. There's no proof, you know. So she actually took her daughter to they told her to take her somewhere all the way in Oklahoma City, which was like an hour drive, that, you know, all the way to some sexually abused
special
center.
Forensics lab or yeah, okay,
like that. Yeah, so that's how she went about this whole thing. But at first the sheriff, they were not interested in this situation. And so but then I find out through Charles that there was never even an investigation. I mean, usually if you're going to file a crime against someone, especially like rape, the police are going to come over and they're going to investigate the crime scene where supposedly the alleged rape happened. And supposedly one of the rapes happened at Charles's mother's house, which would have been his daughter's grandmother. And Mrs. Dyer has never, to this very day, ever had any investigation, any questions about anything. And one of the other supposedly alleged rapes happened during when the girlfriend was home with the child. And Charles, you know, the girlfriend's never even been questioned, no investigation. So there's never even been an investigation on any kind of crime committed at all. They just charged him, and then they came and they arrested him, and so which is absolutely insane to me. So there's been no investigation, and then when you find out also that, you know, during the actual trial, the DA lied to the jury, and I mean, these are the main highlights to me. That,
okay, yeah.
Know, like,
so we start over. So we he's doing well. He's living with his new girlfriend. All of a sudden, the ex-wife all of a sudden drops a big bombshell. Boom, he's raping her daughter or whatever. So the police come over. They did kind of a – not really, didn't even do much of an investigation. He was kind of a
– They had a warrant already
took
in hand. They had a warrant already in hand. Yeah. Well, see, what happened was Charles actually went down to the police station himself when he heard about these charges. He was like, what is this about? So he actually goes down there himself to go walk in and talk to the sheriff. And while he's there, they arrested him while he was there. And they had supposedly – at the same time, there was people, some officers on the way over to the house, and they had they pretty much forced their way in. Not really forced, but they intimidated the girlfriend to let them go ahead and come inside. And while they were inside, they were supposed to only be collecting like a sheet and a pillow or something for where supposedly the claim was that she was raped. And while they were in there, that's when they discovered this military grenade launcher that Charles had. And so that's when they called the feds. Or ATF, one of the two, the sheriff did, and then that's when the ATF and the feds got involved with this strange, you know, military-looking grenade launcher that Charles had, which was he got actually found innocent on those charges. They were dropped, but that's how the whole thing started with the FBI coming involved, and that's how they got into the house. So they arrest Charles, they've got the girlfriend there, they're threatening the girlfriend to, you know, let them come inside, and they were threatening her with arresting her if they didn't let them come inside the home. So that's pretty much illegal search.
Yeah,
so they
didn't have a warrant or anything? Yeah, they just she didn't know, and she was just scared and let them in.
Right. So that's how they got involved. So now he's arrested. And with this grenade launcher charge. And so he was actually arrested for almost 4.5 months staying in Stevens County on this new weapons charge, a federal charge now, and then the state had the sexual abuse charge on him at the same time. And so he had no bond the judge would not give him any bond at all on the federal charge. So he sat in jail for 4.5 months without a bond until he had to go to trial for his federal charge. So, and he was acquitted on that charge, on the grenade launcher.
Okay.
And then, so he gets out on bond, and the judge finally sets a bond at $1 million, which is way too high.
Wow.
Because he was affiliated with these, you know, organizations, which is considered profiling, which is another violation. A judge should never use any sort of excessive bond as a form of oppression, which is, in my opinion, is what they did. But they got the bond down to, I think, $250,000, I think, and the family had to put their farm up to actually have a bond issued so they could get him out of jail for the state felony charge. So that's how they had to put the family farm up on bond to get him out. So then he was out, and he was, you know, waiting for his next trial, which was set for August of last summer. And like I said, that's around the time frame I stepped in when I met him in person. I found out some of the details, and he told me about this DNA report that no one has ever heard about. They've been sitting on this forensic DNA report for like a year, and it's never been put out there for the people to see. And he had a gag order. The judge also put a gag order on Charles when he got out of jail, restricting him from making any kind of public statements or any kind of YouTube videos. Or they told him he cannot talk about anything that happened during the first trial, or they would revoke his bond and they would arrest him. So he had a gag order, which is against his First Amendment right, and so he was not allowed to talk about it. So when I come into the situation and I see this DNA report and I'm looking at it right there in my hand, I'm like, well, this proves your innocence. I mean, it says right here you've been excluded from this, you know, report. So there's no physical evidence. There's nothing to tie you to this crime. And so I asked him if I could take the DNA evidence for him and put it on YouTube. And so that's what I did. I got involved by spreading the DNA evidence out there for whoever wanted to look at this, trying to hopefully generate support from supporters that, you know, follow Charles, so people could actually have something in their hand to look at and see how the prosecutor lied during the first trial. We all know that. And here we have the evidence to show what he was lying about. And that was the beginning of my involvement in trying to help him with that. So.
Wow. All right. Very good. Let me, we are kind of approaching the break here. So why don't we take a couple of minutes for break, and then we'll recharge and then get to the, so this is the part of the story where you're entering the picture, and then things are going to get even crazier from here. So, all right, well, why don't we take a couple minutes, and we'll get back on the other side and finish the story and maybe take some calls here. So this is Blake the Eccentric Perspective on Freedomizers. Stick around. You don't want to miss this. Thank you.
This is Mercy. If you're listening to this message, warriors, you are the resistance. Warriors, you are not alone. There are pockets of resistance all around the planet. We are at the brink. Read about it in The Sovereign, newspaper of the resistance. Available now at newsstands everywhere. The Sovereign is a monthly 24-page tabloid newspaper featuring incendiary content about life during wartime in the age of Obama. Warriors, keep to date every month. Remember to read The Sovereign, newspaper of the resistance. Available at newsstands everywhere. This alert is for all you boppers out there in the big city, all you street people with an ear for the action. This is Mercy. If you're listening to this message, warriors, you are the resistance. This is Mercy. Mine will be the last voice you'll ever hear. Don't be alarmed.
Hi, folks. Joanne Moretti here, inviting you to tune in at 6 p.m. Eastern, that's 3 p.m. Pacific, Monday through Thursday, for Liberty Underground, The Moretti Report, the best 6 o'clock news on the web. Please join me, as well as my great co-host, JoJo Norton, and our chat moderators, Lynn and Anna, as we bring you the latest news, current events, analysis, and an occasional featured guest. That's 6 p.m. Eastern, Monday through Thursday, right here on Freedomizer Radio.
Hey, Val Villano here. I want to encourage you to stop by on Sunday nights from 4 to 6 p.m.
Pacific Time, right here on Freedomizer Radio. Val Volano Show, we will be covering things of deprogramming from the world and the system and dogma and religion. Basically, anything and everything is going to set your mind free, and that's what it's all about, people. So come on by Sunday night, 4 to 6 p.m. Pacific Time, right here, where freedomizers are fighting for their freedom.
Lindsay Williams on Freedomizer Radio.
Proof Negative, I love the title that you use on your radio. I've thought about it ever since we talked on off of the air the other day, and I'd say that that's an excellent title for a talk show host.
All right, and we're back. Blake the eccentric perspective on Freedomizer Radio, joined by Deborah Swan. So we're just getting into a very compelling story here about, I guess, Oath Keeper or spokesperson or Charles. Sorry, what's up?
Charles Dyer.
Charles Dyer, yeah. Say Swan there. So Charles Dyer. So he gets some crazy charges against him. He goes to court. The DNA evidence, so this is a court date about the alleged rape of his own 7-year-old daughter, which is just defies any kind of belief that anyone would do something like that. I'd say that it happens or whatever, but that didn't seem – he seems like a pretty respectable guy. The only issue that I had is that he seems to – he maybe made himself a little bit of an easy target, just was – some of the YouTube videos where he wears a mask, I guess, on the surface to somebody without much knowledge of the information, he might look like somebody who's a little scary. But once you hear him speak, he's actually surprisingly well-spoken and intelligent. So I really have a hard time believing these allegations. But you said there's some they go down to a lab for the girl, and the DNA evidence is – now, here's the number I picked up. 1 in 750 trillion.
That's what and the way the DNA report, you can actually view the DNA report on my YouTube channel. There's a link if you want to go and look at it yourself and upload it and take a look at it. But, yeah, it says it's excluded. There's, like, the chances are of the chance of that actually being connected to Charles is outrageous number. Yeah, it's an outrageous chance. So it excludes him from that report. So the DNA, there was skin DNA that was found, but everybody, like I said, I mean, the skin DNA was found, but there's also skin DNA from the girlfriend, from her daughter, from, you know, his daughter, everyone, everywhere. So that's just, it's a different kind of DNA. But the sperm DNA that they manipulated during the trial and said that was found was not really there. So they played off the ignorance of the jury. And Charles's attorney just said the defense rests after that statement, and Charles said he was about ready to come out of his chair. He was really, you know, really angry that his attorney was not saying anything, and the attorney whispered to Charles and said, "We don't want to make the judge mad. We don't want to make the district attorney mad. The jury has a copy of the DNA report. It'll be fine. You know, they'll figure it out." And so that's how the whole thing ended during his first trial.
So this is the first trial in this attorney. Now, you had some interesting story about this attorney. How did he find this attorney?
Well, this attorney, honestly, I don't know. I don't know.
Oh, okay, not the first trial. Okay.
Yeah, the second attorney.
Okay.
We
can get into that in the second case.
Right.
So he does get out on $1 million bond.
Yeah, it was reduced down to, I believe, $250,000 and maybe either $150,000 or $250,000. I don't remember exactly, but they had to put the family farm up to get him out to come out. They signed the farm over to get him out. Yeah. Wow is right, yeah. And he's never been in trouble before, ever.
Oh, he's got no criminal record, and they have really no DNA evidence, but they pleaded on it with the ignorance of the jury. Okay.
And now they're saying, now the media is running wild at this time, saying that he's a Timothy McVeigh, Oath Keeper, militia, child rapist. You know, these crazy, slanderous, you know, all over the media at this point.
Yeah, and unfortunately, as well-spoken as he is with that mask, it's so easy to, you know, make him look like a monster when, you know, on the surface, because for the average person is just going to see that and go, oh, my God, this is an evil person, and they're not actually going to look any further and investigate to see if he's a legit person or not. So,
absolutely.
Yeah, it's unfortunate. So what happens next? He's out on bond. How long is he out for before he has a second trial?
Well, this was, I believe the first trial was in April, and the second trial was upcoming on August the 15th. And so I met Charles around the end of May. So we were trying to figure out ways. And like I said, it was very quiet. He had one, the support team that that is still very much involved, they were not, honestly, I mean, I hate to say this, but they were not really doing a whole lot for Charles. They would do just a little bit to make it appear like that they're helping him, but they weren't. And the only picture they had floating around about Charles on all of his websites and everything was that damn skull mask. So when I saw this, his support, and I was trying to start putting the pieces together, and I'm seeing, wow, this is not good, you know. And so I'm the one that actually got his mother to release a military, you know, in his uniform, the photo that would be much better to promote Charles out there to the people. And so we got a better picture of him started around, and then I started to try to come up with different ways working with Charles quietly, though, because at the time, you know, he wasn't allowed to be, you know, speaking about any of this. So I pretty much was, I told Charles I would be his voice for him, and I'd try to speak out about the truth on what happened to him since he was not allowed to talk about anything. So I pretty much, he shared with me, and I, you know, I don't have a gag order on me. So I started trying to get out there and trying to help expose the truth for him by my own YouTube videos, and they're not very good, but, you know, they do say what, you know, at the time what we wanted to say, and
no, I
that's
thought
how
they were good. Yeah, I got a couple of those I've seen, yes. And so,
they were all right. They were decent, I guess. You know, I've never done a YouTube video in my life until I did those, so.
No, very good. So you jump in and offer some assistance, and then he goes to a second trial.
He didn't go to the second trial. That's the whole thing. During the summer, this is where it gets crazy for me. And I'm allowed to speak about some things because I was forced, and I say forced immunity. I'll explain that here in a second. But I am under an immunity order through the federal district court of Oklahoma. So some things I cannot say, but I can say that I was the one that picked that. I moved Charles. I was very in fear for his life at the time. I was witnessing all of the corruption and the outright just, I knew he was in trouble. And the mother had shared with me during the first trial that she had heard two or three of the deputies that were there during an intermission, like a break during the first trial. They were out in the hall area, and they said this very loud so she could hear it. And they said that, you know, they're going to make sure Charles is put in general population when he gets convicted to see how long he lasts. And so that's a threat against his life.
Wow.
And his mother.
You're going to put him in Gen Pop. All right.
Absolutely, yeah. His mother went to the sheriff and tried to report this, you know, threat. And the sheriff, McKinley's his name, he said he would take care of it. But nothing ever happened. So we have that threat. There was another situation happened. The father of the ex-wife pointed a weapon. They saw, you know, Charles and his girlfriend on the road traveling, and there was a weapon drawn on Charles. He was going to shoot Charles. There was a lot of harassment going on, and he just wasn't getting the support, and the truth wasn't getting out there fast enough. And we had another radio show he and I did together with Mark Kornke, just trying to get people to do things. Like, we had one idea of having people start faxing the governor, faxing the district attorney, sending faxes in to let everyone know these certain, you know, departments that we, the people, have seen his state evidence. We know that there's nothing to tie him to this crime. You know, we're basically watching, and we want to make sure he gets a fair trial, this next trial. And so he went into the judge and saw the judge and asked for a continuance from the judge. He was denied. The judge said no. And, you know, when you know that it's corrupt, because you just got out of a corrupt situation, the district attorney is corrupt, everything went really bad, he wanted to, you know, change a venue. They would not do that for him either. And so he even tried to fire his attorney, and the judge denied him that. So he can't fire his attorney. He can't get a change of venue. And then his house gets leveled to the ground the Friday before his trial. Friday, early morning on Friday, the 12th, I think it's the 12th of August. He is called, and he hears his house, his trailer was completely leveled. Okay. Everything gone, toast. And so that really scared him. Yeah. And so all this evidence was in there. A lot of this, and he had nothing left except the clothes off his back, on his back, and that was it. And so he goes into another emergency, in front of the judge, asking for a continuance of only 1 week, just a week, so he can get himself ready. I mean, his house just got leveled, and his parents didn't even know if he was in the house or not. It was a really scary situation. And the feds were already involved in the house being burnt down, which is very strange. Why are the feds still involved in this? I mean, the whole thing, the federal part, he was found not guilty on the weapon. So the feds are still, the feds were during the first trial. There was undercover feds there. There were, and the same fed that was involved in the first trial, or the gun charge, was, you know, attending these other charges for the state, talking to people and stuff. And one of his main supporters is Rick Light. He's very connected to the same FBI agent. So all this weird stuff is going on, and he's starting to put it together, like, I'm being set up. He's starting to feel like, now this is a total setup against me. If I go into that trial again in front of the same judge with the same district attorney, with my same attorney, I'm not going to be able to walk out. And so he felt like his life was in danger. I felt like his life was in danger. So I decided to remove him. And I don't call it that he ran. He wasn't running because he was guilty. He was running because he was being persecuted. And so that's a whole different, you know, idea in my mind. The guy needed help. And so that's when I moved him to a different location. And I was trying to help, you know, keep him safe. And hopefully I could help raise support on my own by helping other people get the truth out there and hopefully hold these people accountable from the first trial. But never did he and I ever think that there would ever be a 12-state manhunt looking for this guy after I removed him. They were already looking for Charles the weekend before. He was supposed to be in court on Monday. They were already looking for him on Friday and Saturday. So the feds were already involved looking for him. So it was started getting really crazy around that point. We start, you know, I put him where I put him, and I drive away, and I go off, you know, I went to Florida on vacation trying to put some space between he and I, and he had his plan. He was going to, you know, move forward on, we had a plan, and the plan got messed up because of this manhunt, and that's when the whole thing got, you know, got very dangerous, basically.
Okay. So can you speak more on the federal involvement? Now, I know these, you know, I listen to a lot of, other hosts and stuff speaking about the feds infiltrating some of the militia groups and stuff like that. So what can you talk about on that issue, if there was something going involved, if there were feds involved that may have been, you know, affecting what was going on with his life at that time?
Well, at the time, I wasn't really sure. I knew that there was – I had my speculations on it, and I'm going to name names right now because I just feel like I need to. Rick Light, Minuteman, he's one of the – he's a self-proclaimed militia leader over the well-regulated American militia. I know Rick before all this started with Charles. I had some issues with him when I was really gung-ho, and I jumped in 2 feet in this whole patriot militia movement myself, and then I realized very quickly how dangerous it was, and how this whole thing is infiltrated by a lot of informants. And this isn't conspiracy theory. I mean, if you look for the facts, you'll even see ABC News reported in, like, 2009. I think the FBI had 15,000 paid undercover informants that were infiltrating the active patriot groups. I mean, that's a lot of people, 15,000 people. Yeah, that's a lot of people.
Yeah, just for infiltration, yeah.
for just the patriot community, for militia groups, whatever. And so, it's very real. And so when I got involved with Rick Light, same person, Minuteman is his handle, I knew he was dangerous. And so I started seeing when Charles was, not to backtrack, but when Charles was being held on his federal charge for the grenade launcher, he was in jail. That's when, right around that time frame, I broke away from Rick Light, Minuteman, because I was training with him with my Patriot Survival Group. I was taking out to his place, and anyhow, I knew that this guy was bad because he passed my daughter a sawed-off. It ended up being a sawed-off shotgun, sawed off by 2 inches. Okay, crazy.
Yeah.
But I was targeted to be set up myself, and I'm on the Southern Poverty Law Center's terror. All this crazy stuff was going on, so I started realizing how dangerous this whole movement is right now. And so I saw Charles. I didn't know him personally yet, but I saw Rick Light claiming that he knew Charles from way back. Him and Charles go way back, and his brother's in trouble. We got to come together. So I'm starting to see Rick, you know, speaking like he knew Charles really well. And so I contacted Charles's mom, asked if I could write Charles while he was in jail. She said no one other than the family has written him yet, so she would be thrilled if somebody would write him. So I wrote Charles a letter warning him about Rick Light before he even got out, saying, hey, this guy's bad news. I don't know if you know him, but he claims he knows you. And just please, you know, stay away from him. Well, that's how the whole thing with my warnings. And when, sure enough, when Charles got out of jail on bond, Rick Light was there immediately. And he basically fooled Charles. And to this day, he still has Charles thinking that Rick is a big supporter of Charles Dyer. But he's not. Rick Light is working with the feds. He admits he works with the FBI. He was part of the manhunt when the feds were hunting Charles down. Rick Light was working directly with all these different departments. There's even a letter that he wrote claiming he's working with all these departments. Ken Western is the FBI agent out of Lawton, Oklahoma. That's the one that's been involved with Charles, openly involved with Charles' situation. And he's the one that knows Rick Light very well. They work together. I mean, they work hand in hand. And so anyone that's in the militia movement knows the feds hate the militia. I mean, they hate us. They want anyone that's in a militia or any that's pro-constitutional or pro-militia, the feds don't like that at all. And so for Rick to claim that, you know, these feds that he works with are good guys, and that is completely absurd. So that's where I started seeing the federal connection. You know, when the manhunt was going on, all of a sudden Rick Light's working with the feds. Here I am trying to run away from with Charles somewhere safe, and we have supposedly his, you know, best friend is what Rick claims, that him and Charles are like brothers. He's hunting him down with the FBI. And so, and it's never stopped. Ever since the manhunt, they, you know, Charles ended up turning himself in 12 days later, by the way. He had him going for 12 days. That's pretty impressive. He was able to help. That's pretty impressive. And so, actually, Charles got really, he was very hungry and he was very, you know, worn out. And it was getting more and more dangerous. I mean, the level of force that they were using was out of control. I experienced it myself when I was in Florida. You know, without a warrant, we had the Pensacola FBI and the SWAT, the local SWAT team. They had the whole area in Destin, Florida, surrounded. I find out later it was the whole area was blocked off, and they came storming through my vacation home I was staying at with about 30 people that were in the home sleeping. We're all sleeping from infants, you know, small children all the way up to, you know, elderly people. Sleeping, and they ripped me out of my bed, armed, you know, the AR-15s, the whole riot gear, the whole shebang. I mean, I woke up and I see this like black helmeted with a flashlight right on his helmet with an AR-15 right there in my face, pulling me off the top bunk, and it was crazy. And so, they're pulling me out of my underwear, I was in my underwear, they pulled me all the way outside, and I'm looking around, and I'm seeing all my family and friends and everyone being pulled out one by one, taken to the front yard, and I assumed that they had some sort of search warrant, but none of my friends knew anything about any of this stuff. They didn't even know who Charles was, okay, they had no idea. So they pull me through this commotion, just crazy, lights, guns everywhere. There's about 15 FBI agents outside, and the first thing they do to me is they shove a picture of Charles Dyer in my face, and they ask me if I knew where he was. And, of course, you know, I'm going to lie. I lied and said no. I wasn't going to say anything. They had no warrant, I find out, so I don't have to talk to these feds at all. They had no right to be involved in this at all, period. So they interrogated me for about 45 minutes. I was in handcuffs the whole time, and as, you know, they're pulling my friends and stuff out of the house, one of the deputies, you know, my friends and family, they assumed that Charles was like a serial killer. They had no idea what was going on. They had just assumed that this guy was like a really, really bad, bad, you know, criminal.
Yeah.
And so when my boyfriend's sister asked one of the deputies, who is this guy? What did he do? He tells the family that he was on his way to kill people and he had explosives on him. That's the rumor that they're telling all my family and friends, and that he had explosives. His name's Charles Dyer. And he has explosives, and he's on his way to kill people. And so they were terrified. They could not, I mean, everybody was just completely rattled to the core, terrified of whatever this person was. And so once everyone was gone and they let me go and they, you know, everything was calmed down for the moment, they told me to pack my stuff and get out. They're like, whoever this is crazy. You need to get your stuff and you need to go. And it was so crazy.
They really have it out for this guy. All right.
Yes, well, big time. And it was so bad that my boyfriend's brother, they actually left at like 3:30 in the morning. They were driving back to Texas early. And this is before they had ransacked the home. They were all, you know, parked wherever they were surrounding the place, you know, trying to hide, I guess. But a group of these guys were told to follow the family that left. because they didn't know who they were. And they pulled Jake, his name was Jake, they pulled him over on the highway armed with assault rifles pointing at the family the whole time. And there's, you know, now they know Charles is not in this vehicle, I'm not in the vehicle, and they still had the weapons drawn the entire time. They never lowered their weapons once. And there was two small children and a baby and his wife and you know, the husband, and that's it. And like an hour later, they finally lowered the weapons and they freed them, they cleared them to leave. But that's how insane. And there was, all of this was done without any kind of warrant. There was not any warrant. And when I found out how they got inside, this is what how they did that. To get inside the house, because they were all waiting for somehow the door to open up, you know. And
right.
This is like a $10,000 a week, very, very nice townhome in Destin, right there on the beach. So they're all outside waiting for somehow the door to get opened. And I find out later that the way they got the door opened is that when they had the family pulled over on the highway, Jake, they told Jake, the SWAT team told Jake that he's going to call his father, wake him up, and make him think that Jake had a flat tire and that he needed his help. So Jake had to call his dad, wake him up at 4 o'clock in the morning, lie to him, and say, Dad, we're over here, we're on the highway, we have a flat tire, can you come help us? So, of course, you know, Jake's father gets his keys and his wife, and they're opening up the front door thinking they're going to walk out to help, you know, their son. And there's AR-15s and guns just, like, pointing right there at his face. And the Fed shoves a picture of myself and Charles in his face and asks, do you know where these two people are? And that's how they got the door open. And so, of course, who's going to say, no, you can't come in when you got AR-15s shoved in your face?
But yeah.
Of course, he
stepped
aside.
That's crazy, and they got no warrant. Yeah,
no warrant. See, that's how they got the door open. They're saying that they were invited. Because when I asked them, I'm like, how'd you get inside the house without a warrant? And they said, we were invited inside. They were invited. Well, who's going to say, no, you can't come inside? So they're like, yes, we know who she is. She's inside sleeping, but I've never seen this guy before. And they said, well, we're coming in to make sure we have to, you know, locate her and find out if he's being hidden somewhere. So that's how they got inside the house.
Ah, okay. All right. So, Deborah, we're down to about 7 minutes left in this show, and I got one caller on hold for sure. I know the caller even knows Charles, but I also, just to kind of wrap this up, and I'm sorry we don't have a little more time. Maybe we can have you on again to wrap everything up. But what's the latest going on right now? So they stick him in Gen Pop. He's obviously in danger if the other inmates find out that he's, you know, allegedly raped a 7-year-old. That's probably pretty a dangerous situation even for a Marine. But maybe you could just tell us what's the latest, and then we can maybe take a call.
Unfortunately, he finally got his trial. It was completely hijacked, and they offered him a plea. He refused the plea before the trial. The plea was if he would agree to 8 more months, they would have let him out. I don't know all the details, but I'm sure they had some sort of objectives again for him to go. I'll tell you that the next time. But anyway, so he's got 30 years, no rights for parole. He's in a maximum security facility, and he's waiting for his appeal. But there's a lot more details to share with you. But right now, I'm trying to get a petition going that is going, you know, because as I've mentioned a little bit, there's a lot of violations that's happened. His due process was violated, his habeas corpus, every way you can imagine was violated. So we have rights, I believe, as citizens to help him by petitioning this and to get this reversed. And so hopefully we can get enough support going for him before the appeal is over with, which is coming up, I believe, the beginning of August. And his life is in danger right now, absolutely. So he has he's not in a good spot right now.
And
so
is there anything you have right now where people could go to get more information? Yeah, we'd probably have you on, because if the next trial is coming up in August, I mean, that's only a couple more weeks away.
I'm sorry, there's no other trial. He's he's already been convicted. Unfortunately,
okay.
Yeah, there's an appeal he's trying to do, an appeal. But,
okay.
But yeah, there's a lot more details. But right now, if people can sign the petition, if you go to my YouTube video, my YouTube channel, which is Swan Deborah, all lowercase, you can find it there. Just do a search on Charles Dyer petition on Google. I'm trying to put together a WordPress actually this evening. Dan's going to help me with that. So we have a place for everyone to go with all the information, lots of recorded conversations, lots of proof of all the stuff I'm claiming. It's not just speculating. It's all
verified. Okay, yeah, that'd be great. Yeah, then we can re-summarize everything, and we can have you up again, and we can discuss this in more detail. So,
crazy.
All right, without further ado, do you want to take a call real quick?
Sure, go for it. Yeah.
Okay, this is somebody I believe that knows Charles. Larry, you are up on the air.
good deal. Hey, I don't know if I know you or not. I talked to a lot of people years ago, or it's been a couple of years ago. Look, get a hold of a lawyer named Bill Neal out of Dallas. I didn't know Charles got convicted of anything. I thought it was still pending.
No, he's got years, yeah. Was it Bill Neal, N-I-E-L?
Yeah, he's out of Dallas. He's technically retired, but certain kinds of cases really pissed him off,
okay?
Prosecutors fear Bill Neal. I know that for a fact. He doesn't play the good old boy game, and he's not afraid of pissing off a judge. In fact, he enjoys pissing off judges and prosecuting attorneys, okay? I've been out of the loop for a long time. To make a long story short, I have a stupid phone. I don't have a smartphone, and I'm on the road driving a truck these days, and so I don't have access to the computer, internet, all this garbage. Man, I wish I'd have known all this a long time ago. But I thought everything was taken care of, and it was a done deal. He was free and easy, so I wasn't even worried about anything.
It was so. It's been so federally corrupt. I mean, this guy, they have big plans for Charles.
Okay, here's the problem. Newer loaded people, and I hate to sound like Alex Jones or anything like this, but the newer loaded people hate us, okay?
Yes,
they want us dead. I mean, it's obvious. They admit it in their own writings. I mean, it's not conspiracy theory. It's conspiracy fact. People don't believe it. Go look at the whack jobs writings. But all that aside, this is more important. Bill Neal is really, really good. I've seen prosecutors tremble when he walks into a courtroom. And judges go, oh, shit.
He's not compromisable. You don't think he's compromisable? Because my friend of mine just came in, an active U.S. military officer out of Afghanistan contacted me and dumped $10,000 into an investigative firm called the U.S. Observer, and they have been compromised. $10,000 and they're totally compromised. And so,
yeah,
I mean,
a lot of people have gotten compromised. They're like all thinking they're going to be able to be minions of the NWO and have power and all this other crap. You really have to be careful. One, appeal. To no ends, but ineffective counsel. For one, the lawyer actually admits that he was afraid to piss off a judge and a prosecutor.
Yes.
First of all, do you have a right to fire your lawyer? A judge can't tell you no. Can
exactly.
We say F you? Hey, are you Metal Chick on YouTube?
I'm Deborah. I'm Swan Deborah on YouTube. You could
I used to talk to some of these people.
Hey, guys, so we only got about a minute, so.
Well,
okay,
crap.
Thanks for calling.
You guys have the floor, so
hey,
go ahead.
Off air, Blake, off air.
Yeah.
Give her my phone number, man. And if you want to, give me a call.
All right.
Thanks for calling.
I can set that up. Larry, good to hear from you, buddy.
Likewise, man.
Thanks. Okay, well, are we over time?
We're about in the last minute here. So, Deborah Swan, once again, do you want to, you said you're going to get a WordPress blog or something going up soon, and then maybe we can have you on again and we can go over this story again and summer everything up and have a website to go to. But do you want to plug anything or, again, for anybody to support you, just go to Swan Deborah, that's SwanDeborah. That's the YouTube channel. Okay. They can get in contact with you there.
There's a chip in if anybody wants to donate to the family for his commissary or, you know, anything like that. There's two chip ins, one through his sister and one through his mother. If you go to there is a Facebook page, I hate to say it, but it's infiltrated, but that's where the chip in is. It's called Patriots for Justice. In the case of Charles Dyer, you'll find a chip in link there. And we're probably out of time now. I'll post my email in the chat room if people want to help by getting in touch with me. That'd be great. So,
sure, absolutely. Hey, thanks for being us. Quite the compelling story.
Yes, it is.
All right. So. Deborah, good to hear from you. Take care. I'll talk to you again very soon.
You have a good one. Thanks so much.
All right. See you later. Okay, and thanks for listening, everybody. This is Blake the Eccentric. I'm signing off. I'll be back on Monday. Thank you all. Have a wonderful day.
You know the Constitution like the back of your hand. You've read books, listened to podcasts, attended lectures, surfed websites, and watched videos. You've made liberty your life's goal, but something seems to be missing. Stickers from LibertyStickers.com. Exercise your freedom of speech with the world's most dangerous bumper stickers. That's LibertyStickers.com. But wait, there's more. You can buy Liberty stickers wholesale. Get them for 99 cents each when you put 100 or more in your shopping cart in any combination. Sell them or give them away. They're great for gun shows, flea markets, fairs, outreach, and more. Earn extra money, promote freedom, and spread the word. Need custom stickers, labels, or decals for your organization or business? Liberty Stickers makes them. Go to LibertyStickers.com to order or call 877-873-9626. LibertyStickers.com, the world's most dangerous stickers.
Hey everybody, welcome to the special Tax Day edition of the Valerie Sergeant Martin Show. I'm your host, Valerie Sergeant Martin. Thanks for joining us. We're speaking of Tax Day. Made me think of a Winston Churchill quote. You guys probably have heard it already, but he said, "There is no such thing as a good tax." And I hope everybody that listens to the Valerie Sergeant Martin Show understands that. We're going to talk a little bit about taxes today. We've got a special guest, Nolan Cox. He is the president of Crown Chemicals out of Valdosta, Georgia. He's also Lowndes County, Georgia, chairman of the GOP there. And he is coming on the show today to talk to us about the proposed T-SPLOST. That's a 1% sales tax that will be on the ballot in July here in the state of Georgia. He's going to tell us why it's bad, I believe. That's what he's coming to say. And so it's going to be an interesting first hour of the show. And then on the second hour, we're going to have Macon attorney Jason Downey. He was selected yesterday to become a delegate to the Republican National Convention at Georgia's 8th District Convention. So he'll come on and give us his thoughts on what happened yesterday. It's going to be an interesting two-hour show today. I was also an attendee of the 8th District Convention yesterday, and I was also chosen to be a part of the Republican National Convention in August in Tampa, Florida. I, however, was not chosen to be a delegate. I was selected to be an alternate. So I will talk more about that when Jason comes on in the next hour. We had, for those who don't know, here in the state of Georgia, you get three delegates and three alternates from each of the 14 congressional districts here in the state of Georgia. And in the 8th district, I was one of the alternates. The entire slate went like this. Vivian Childs out of Houston County was a delegate. Jason Downey out of Bibb County was a delegate. Roy Campbell, I can't remember what county Roy was from, he was a delegate. And then Barbara Schmader and Lott Dill were chosen as fellow alternates. So the convention was very smooth, but there's some backstory there. So we'll talk more about that in a minute when we get Nolan on the line. Nolan was there as well. Our Congressman Austin Scott came and spoke after the convention, and it was a good speech for Austin Scott, one of the better ones I'd ever heard him give. But there was a little bit of controversy at the end when he was asked about his vote on the National Defense Authorization Act, the act that permits the United States to hold U.S. citizens indefinitely without trial. He was questioned about his vote on that bill at the luncheon after the convention. So it'll be interesting to see that on video. I have some comments on that as well. We'll talk about that later in the show. So we've got a good show ahead for us all. The number to call in if you'd like to speak with our guests or me is 347-324-3704. And we don't necessarily have to talk about any of these issues. We can talk about whatever you want to talk about. You can also join us at the freedomizerradio.com chat room. We've got a few folks there talking right now. The chat room is always lively and interesting. The chat room doesn't necessarily follow everything I'm saying here on on the show. But it's always fun, so join us there. I wanted to mention to everyone that freedomizerradio.com is reaching the masses. We are consistently ranking in the top 25,000 sites as ranked by Alexa. So if you have a business that would like to reach a national audience, you need to think about advertising with us here on freedomizerradio.com. We're going to take a quick break, and then when we come back, we'll have Nolan Cox to talk about Georgia's proposed new T-SPLOST. So I hope you'll stick around. This is the Valerie Sargent Martin Show.
Do you believe we are not alone? Are you intrigued by the paranormal and psychic phenomena? Have you ever wondered if there was something abnormal about how the society operates? Do you believe you are here to do more on this planet? Do you feel as though you are living in a prison country or planet rather than a sovereign nation? Does it feel like you never had any constitutional rights or that they are ignoring it as if it wasn't important? Join me, Joanna Johnston, psychic empath and spiritual warrior, on Illuminating Minds on freedomizerradio.com every Sunday night, 7:30 p.m. to 9 p.m. Pacific Standard Time, beginning on January 8th, to move further down the rabbit hole.
Welcome back, everybody, to the Valerie Sargent Martin Show. Our number to call in is 347-324-3704. On the line with us, we've got Nolan Cox, president of Crown Chemicals out of Valdosta, Georgia. He's also the chairman of the Lowndes County, Georgia GOP. Nolan, thanks for coming on the Valerie Sargent Martin Show.
You're welcome, Valerie. I want you to know you bumped me out of my trip to Tampa.
Hey, I didn't vote for that first slate. I was holding out for the one that had you and me both on there. That was the one I was going to vote for. So seriously, I didn't even stand up for that first slate. But lucky for me, I was on 4 out of the 5 there, so I was going to get to go one way or the other. Thank goodness. But I had to
tease you a little bit about that. I'm glad you're going.
Well, that's okay. I really think you should have been on there. And gosh, we just didn't have the numbers we needed there, Nolan. What are we going to do about that the next go around?
I don't know. And I didn't know they were going to submit me. If they had just put me in there and left the other people alone, it had a good chance of passing. But they knocked off some really good people, I thought.
Yeah, two in particular were you worried about being excluded. I think they changed Roy Campbell and put you in Roy Campbell's place.
Yeah, and I don't know Roy that well. But anyway, that's all history.
Well, I want to talk more about that after we get through talking about the T-Splos, because
okay.
I was really interested. I think everybody's going to be interested to hear your take on this T-Splos, and I'm not feeling well today. I'm sort of under the weather, I guess, just from all the running around we've had to do for this convention stuff. So I'm going to let you talk as much as you want to talk, and I'm only going to interrupt you if I got a question.
Okay. That may be dangerous.
No, I think it'll be great. I think it'll be good, because everything you said yesterday was stuff I had never heard before. So go ahead and share with our listeners what you told everybody yesterday.
Okay. I'll give them a little background on myself. I'm 69 years old. I've been working all my life. I still run a company. I've got employees that really depend on the company and me, and so I've stayed in it for their benefit. My wife and I started the local Valdosta Tea Party in 2009, and surprisingly, we had about 500 people show up. At the time, we had about 15 people in the Republican Party that was active members, and the so the next year when I ran for county chairman, I took about 50 Tea Party people over to the Republican Party with me, and that's how I got voted in. But we have added a bunch of Ron Paul people this year, probably another 15 people from the Ron Paul, and hopefully we'll salvage some of them. They're young people. And as I told Vivian yesterday, we got way too much gray hair in our party here. We need more young people. We need more minorities. And they're welcome. We want to get them in. What I find is even the minorities believe in what we believe. They're just intimidated to come associate with us. They've all got gatekeepers in their community. And if they come hang out with the Republicans, they got to listen to the gatekeepers. And it's really a tragic situation. We have so much in common, and yet, you know, we're not working together.
Yeah, I agree. And I think one of the great things about Ron Paul is that he crosses all sorts of cultural and socioeconomic barriers.
He does.
His message of freedom and liberty appeals to everybody. And
yeah.
I agree with you also that there's a lot of pressure for especially African Americans not to get involved with Republican politics. And in our 8th District Party, we've done a great job at making good strides at including African Americans in the 8th District. And our chairwoman is an African American, and she wants to appeal to more like herself, and we have. But she agrees with you that it's hard to make the sale with other African Americans, because the Republican Party has tended to be very closed to just about everybody, not just minorities, but they were just very specific about what kind of people they wanted to be officially and formally part of the party. And I don't think it's a racial thing. I just think it's sort of a
Bowery, I think, is a media paintbrush. They're painting us that way. And it's not
right.
Really true.
Right. Well, you could be right. I just know from my experience, you know, I come from more of a blue-collar background than a white-collar background. And
hey, are no collars on overalls. That's where I came from. It's not blue-collar or white-collar.
Right. And so I sort of, you know, if you're a working-class person, it's kind of hard to make your way, or it seems like it's hard to make your way into the Republican Party. And you're right, it could be a perception thing that we are having trouble getting past the media trying to draw that picture for everybody. And I agree with you there. And so it's good for us to have other alternative media to say to people that that's not true and we're not all like that. And so come on in and be a part of the GOP.
Well, let me touch a little bit on the T-Splos. It's got so many names. It's called the Transportation Investment Act of 2010. It's been nicknamed T-Splos, even though it's not special and it's not local. It's regional. It was passed. A lot of people don't realize this, but it was initially passed in 2009. It was held over. In 2010, they put what I call Section 4 in there, all the social services stuff. I didn't discuss this the other day, but when you get the bill and read it, it is in-depth in social services. They're going to have several new committees have been created to get into, it's called the Georgia Coordinating Committee for Rural and Human Services Transportation of the Governor's Council. And then a subcommittee under that is the State Advisory Subcommittee for Rural and Human Services Transportation. A lot of people have no idea all these social services are integrated into what is considered to be just a transportation bill. Every human service department in the state is a member of the Human Services Transportation Subcommittee. All of the operators, whether they're union, private, public, are involved in input into that subcommittee, along with any groups that are representative. So ACORN, CECAS, the unions, they're all going to be involved in this. And the input from that committee is not even due until 2013, after the bill is passed, supposedly. That's another reason we need to vote against it. It's like Nancy Pelosi, let's vote this in and then we'll tell you what's in it. Another big thing that's in there is regional governance study commissions. We are adopting regional government in Georgia, and the regions, they call them districts in some literature. Well, actually, in some slide presentations, they use regions and districts, meaning the same thing. But the regions that they have drawn out were developed. They say they were new districts created for this act. They were created under Carter in the 1970s and were called social service delivery regions in the 70s. That's where your area planning and development committees came from. They work on those same boundaries. And it's designed to be regional government, to get the government out of the hands of the people. When you look at the government structure that's being set up, the transportation director who runs all this is appointed by the governor. The regional roundtables in each region have been appointed by the legislature. The executive committee in the regional roundtable is elected by the roundtable. The citizens review panel that's going to review the quality, the timeliness, the effectiveness, everything about these programs in the different regions, all of those people in every region of the state are selected by the Speaker of the House. He selects three per region, and the lieutenant governor selects two. So the people that represent us aren't even selected by us. There is nothing in this thing that is bottom-up. They sell it as a bottom-up program for the regions to develop what they want to. It is totally the opposite. And I've debated with the local chamber, and they say it's bottom-up. And I have convinced them it is top-down. The project criteria that decides what type projects will be selected is issued by the Director of Transportation. The roundtable then submits projects to the director for his approval. The director goes through that list and selects projects that meets the statewide long-term transportation goals, And then the director sits down with the executive committee and each region, and they make their choices, and he has to approve of them and the price they put them in at. So then the roundtable votes on what the director of transportation and the executive committee of the region decides, and they can only vote up or down. They can't add or take projects out. And they say this is bottom-up planning. It is absolutely 100% top-down. The only thing that is bottom-up is when the taxpayer votes it down. That's the only bottom-up element in the entire program. And it's such a scam. I mean, it is totally not as presented, not as sold, not as documented. I can go to their websites. In fact, most of my slides in my presentation, I use their slides out of their program and then talk about how they're lying and use the bill and evidence from other slides of theirs that show that what they're selling you isn't true. Now, what I talked about at the convention is one small aspect of this thing, and it's really, really critical. I only found out about it about a month ago, and I had been fighting this since about August of last year. But I was on the Georgia DOT website under Frequently Asked Questions, and you can go to the Georgia DOT website by just putting that in, hitting in Google, and then over in the lower right-hand corner, you'll see transportation referendum. Click on that, and one of the options then is frequently asked questions. And so I'm gonna read some of the questions that I read at the convention the other day, which I think was an eye-opener for you and apparently a lot of other people. You could look at them and tell this was new news to them.
To put a link up on the freedomizerradio.com chat room wall of the frequently asked questions. I'm here on the Georgia DOT's page, and I went down to the transportation referendum, and now what do I click again so I can see their frequently asked questions? Is it under... Here we go. I got it. I'm on
the first one is general. Why is Georgia building additional projects? See that question?
Yep, and I'm going to post the link right here.
Okay.
So we can follow along at home.
The next question down that explains similar information is you have to count six down from there, question six and seven. So let me go through and just tell the people that are listening what it says and why it's so different than what most people think. It says, the question is not really important, it's the answer, but why is Georgia building additional projects when we are having difficulty maintaining our current systems? The answer, and this is the latter part of the answer, in regions that pass the referendum, the revenues generated will supplement funding already appropriated for projects and allow Georgia DOT to redirect federal funding on maintaining our existing roadway. Now, what that means is when the region takes over a project that would have been funded with federal funds, they redirect those funds and we pay for it. We are taking over at the city and county level in Georgia the responsibility of the state and federal government. Now, we taxpayers in Georgia have already paid the taxes, federal and state, that should be coming back to us. In other words, with our federal fuel tax and state fuel taxes, we get those monies back and they're redirected back to us in congressional districts. Now, when we build projects that those funds would have built, we lose that money. We pay for those. They take that money and go somewhere else. I'm going to read you another one here. Can the revenues raised from the regional sales tax be used to match federal funds? Yes, there are many projects in the federal aid pipeline that are good candidates for the regional sales tax. Helping fund the required match with regional sales tax dollars will allow state and local funds to be redirected to other projects. We are taking over their responsibility. All right, third place. What happens if a project chosen for the region's project list is already programmed with federal, state, or local funding? Now, remember, this is going to be a majority of the projects that are already dedicated, like Highway 84, four-laning it across the southern part of the state, the Wiregrass Corridor, several other corridors throughout the state that they've been working on for at least a decade are on that list. Okay, when those projects come up, if federal funds are replaced by the regional sales tax funds, this will allow other projects to advance on the statewide transportation improvement program. So in South Georgia, when we take over one of those projects that they would have built with our money, they take our money and take it somewhere else. Now, a lot of people in the Atlanta area have got projects up there that are only half funded. And I tell them, look, you don't understand. We're going to subsidize your project for you. And they're raising Cain because, you know, they got $5 million coming in on a $10 million project, for example. And they say it's crazy to plan like that. And I said, look, you don't understand. When we pick up our state and federal responsibility, the Georgia DOT is going to have a huge slush fund from all over the state, because cities and counties all over the state are going to pick up the slack for them and take over their projects, and then they're going to move their money to where they want to. And trust me, the Chamber of Commerce in Atlanta is driving this whole thing. They want light rail, heavy rail, express buses, regular buses. They've got a design for four concentric circles with feeder lines around Atlanta. It looks like a huge target with a bullseye in the middle, which is downtown Atlanta, with four circles of transportation going around it, and it goes from Gainesville down to Griffin, Georgia, from Dallas, Georgia, over past Athens. And it's gigantic, and it'll take 20 or 30 years to build. The interesting thing about this tax is it's a 10-year tax, but you can make a 20-year commitment by law. And the law says you can commit for up to 20 years on projects, but it's only a 10-year tax. So what does that tell you? They're expecting a renewal. So it's really shocking to people. And the thing that I can't believe these county commissioners went through and didn't understand it is when they went through all these road projects, nobody asked, well, where's our regular tax money going to go? When are we going to get it? The tax money that we normally get. Well, we're not going to get what we normally got. We're only going to get what was not on the state strategic plan. When we build the state strategic plan with our money, they take that money, which is over half of all building projects, and build them a gigantic slush fund. Over a 10-year period, it's going to be about $9 billion. So what has amazed me is people don't understand it. And I have showed them, like in the ballot question, the question on the ballot that we're going to vote on says, shall blank county transportation system and the transportation network in this region and the state be improved by providing for a 1% special district transportation sales and use tax. Now, my question the first time I saw this is, why does the state need to be on there? They say in all of their presentations, and I've got at least three different presentations of theirs, where it says money raised in the district or in the region stays in the region. If that were true, the state wouldn't need to be a benefactor on these public funds and be approved by the public to receive that money. Now, once the public approves the state to get it, they're going to be able to get it. And the only way to stop it is to vote it down. That's the only way at this point. So, you know, we've got a lot of challenges in here, but I don't know how much you know or if y'all talk about Agenda 21, but this whole regional concept is a component of Agenda 21 to get regional government. And the reason why they want regional government is regional government is not elected by the people in the region directly. In other words, in my region that they created, there's 18 counties, there's 32 people from each county on the board, so there's 36 members on the board, two of them from my county. So if I don't like what the board's doing, I can only vote on two out of 36. Now, here's the ironic thing. If you look at our county breakup, out of the 18 counties, we've got 11 recipient counties, which means they get more money than they put in. We've got 7 donor counties, which mean we put in more money than we get. So there's a huge incentive out here. It's just like welfare. No one on welfare wants to vote it out. All regional planning is, all these regional transportation districts do is redistribute money among counties from each county according to its ability to each county according to its need. You got some counties getting 300% of what they raise in taxes. My county gets back 64% of what it raises. We're the biggest county in our region. We lose $90 million over a 10-year period donating it to other counties. It is pure socialism at the county level. It's just like redistribution of income at the national level. The counties like mine, you can look up the interstate corridor, Lowndes County, Cook County, Tift County, right on up to Bibb County and Macon. They are being drained because of their high tax base and the money's being redistributed to other counties. Now, it's pure socialism, unadulterated socialism designed by a Republican administration. And that's where my grind comes in. I've worked since 1988 in the Republican Party to get conservatives elected. Now we hold the Republicans hold every constitutional office in Georgia, and it is the most corrupt government I've ever seen here. And it's unethical. We tried to introduce an ethics bill this year, and David Ralston, Speaker of the House, said it was DOA. It's going nowhere. It was almost impossible to get a sponsor. And it's telling as to what's going on up there. See, David Ralston and his family was taken by lobbyists to Europe. They reported $14,000 that they spent on the trip to take him over to ride him around on high-speed rail and on public transportation. One of the biggest winners in this whole thing is a company called Siemens. that's out of Germany that makes light rail cars. Comcast is another European company that makes buses. So you can literally follow the money. The engineering groups that engineer all this are actually written into the bill. So
wow.
It's shocking to me.
Okay, so what they're asking, and you, one of the things you hadn't mentioned yet in your conversation with me that you talked about yesterday was this sales tax would increase the Georgia Department of Transportation's budget by 96%.
Yeah, and let me explain that. This year's budget, 2012 and 13, is $1.9 billion. This transportation tax, 1% transportation tax statewide, will bring in $1,866,000,000. So we're going to go, I forget what the total is from, we're going to go from $1.9 billion to $3.76 billion in spending if it passes statewide and everything is done that they want to do. Now, what I'm hoping, and I'm trying to kill it statewide, to go back and, number one, get rid of the regional government aspect. What we need to do is pass a law, and this bill was introduced. A similar bill was introduced back in 08 when this thing started, and it would allow counties that want to work together and tax within, let's say there's three counties along a road that want to work together, or four counties. They can all work together. They sit down, make an agreement on how they're going to split the revenue, what they're going to spend it on, how much tax they need. Now, this is 1% statewide. They may only need a 0.5% to build what they want to build. Then they have the authority to do that. See, there's some areas north of Atlanta where they need more highways to get the people in and out of the city at peak rush hour. And They're inhibited from working together now because they're part of three different regions. So
yeah, I was going to ask you, what keeps them from doing that right now? Why can't they do it that way right now?
Well,
I mean, why does the state not allow counties along a road to get together and jointly raise a tax for road work in those three counties or whatever?
Valerie, the reason why they can't do that now is DOT controls all that. By the Georgia Constitution today, if you, let's say you want to build an amphitheater and you're sitting here with two or three counties that's going to benefit from it, like the one in Macon, those three counties can work on that project and develop a tax to cover that issue, and when it's built, it's over with. But the transportation, the DOT has kept counties from doing that on roads because they want to control it. But what needs to happen is they need to have that ability to work. And the way the current law reads is contiguous counties that join one another, can work on mutual projects. But highways is not one of the things listed in the Constitution. So it would be real simple. Like if they want to build a beltway around North Atlanta and go through eight counties, right now they can't do that with three regions involved or four regions involved, depending on where they build it. But my point is, it's got nothing to do with transportation. It has to do with social engineering, taxing the people and doing what the Atlanta Chamber wants to do. It's got, listen, if you just think about it, the normal thing to have done would be to increase our taxes on fuel Georgia is the 50th in the nation on fuel taxes. We're paying 7.5 cents a gallon on fuel plus 3%. So if you got $4 gas, you got 12 cents there plus another 7.5 cents that goes to transportation back to the areas where the fuel is sold to. Now, it would have been real simple to increase the fuel tax if transportation was in desperate need. Now, here's another thing. Georgia ranks 48th in the nation in semi-tractor-trailer truck tags, license, and fees. All combined, Georgia on a semi-tractor-trailer has a $12,361 fee. Tennessee is $14,000. South Carolina is $13,000. Alabama is $13,000. Florida is $16,000. So we could have changed those two things and just addressed transportation. But listen, everything you buy, you pay tax, not just fuel. When you buy groceries, you're going to pay the transportation 1% tax. Anything you buy, you're going to pay a 1% tax on it to go to roads. Now, the simple thing would have been to do it another way. Now, I don't even advocate that we raise our fuel and semi-tractor-trailer truck. If you go look at the state budget as a whole and study this thing, what you find out is in the last 15 years, we've increased public welfare. We've increased what the state's paying into hospitals. We have almost doubled what we're spending on education in the last 15 years. We're spending more money now than we ever have. We're just not allocating it to roads. And what we're spending it on, we're not getting a return on, and it's not helping the economy. We got dismal education scores, and a lot of our problem has been illegal immigration. That's why our hospital costs, our jails, our welfare, these people are on every program you can think of. And we're spending enough money now. We're just not prioritizing it like it should be. That's why I say we need no new tax. We need to get rid of the splosh taxes that we have now. And I'm going to give you an example. In our county here, we've got an education splosh, and I'm going to use the term splosh to cover all these taxes that we voted in ourselves. We've got one for the city and one for the county. We're raising $25 million a year per tax. So we're putting $75 million a year in my county into splosh taxes. Now, here's why I know it's unnecessary. For 130 years, we ran this city and county with no splosh taxes. Everything got built that needed to be built. Everything was fine. We had all the schools we needed. What we've done is voted ourselves in these taxes, and our local people are swimming in money to spend. Listen, we just built a middle school the other day for $15.3 million. 10 years ago, you would have spent $3.5 million on that school.
$15 million on a middle school?
Yeah.
Oh, my.
I'm telling you, it looks like a Taj Mahal. And my point is the public is so gullible. They've been talked in. Now, the way they sell those taxes in my county, the way they've been sold, and if you know anything about economics, it's a lie. The theory is, and the way the government has sold the people is, hey, all these people from outside the county are coming in here, and they're paying half of our taxes, these extra taxes. Well, that's baloney. Who writes the check? That businessman writes the check to the state. And let me tell you why he ought to be able to keep it. He's the one that either bought or rented the property. He's the one that hired the people to put in there to provide the service or the merchandise. He stocked the store. He took all the risk. He got no subsidies from anybody. And he's the one that ought to get that penny, not the government. And we have been sold, the people are so ignorant about how taxes work. And Churchill said it best. He said, a nation cannot tax itself into prosperity. It's like a man standing in a bucket trying to lift himself by the handle.
Right.
And that's true. When you talk about prospering from tax money, you have to realize that you had to destroy some vision or some dream to get that money to build a project or a dream with. It's like energy. It's neither created nor destroyed. It's just transferred from one place to another. So everything your county does with tax money, it has to either hire people, buy equipment, or buy property. If it buys property, it takes it off the tax rolls. If it buys equipment, it has to be maintained. If it hires people, it's got to be paid forever. So everything they spend money on requires additional money in the future to keep it going. A businessman, when, you know, your grocery store is probably the easiest example. Every week they have to restock that thing, sometimes more than once a week. So all those people that are supplying goods and services are employing people to put those goods and services in the grocery store, and then they're sold and they go out, and you have a multiplier effect. Like when a business moves into a community, you'll hear them talking about, well, this payroll is going to have a multiplied effect of 2, 3, 4 times this amount in the local economy. Well, when you take that money and put it in government, you have a subtractor effect, and it is a negative effect on the economy anywhere from 2, 3, 4 times what you would have got if you had left it in industry. And
all right. Go ahead. Well, I was just going to say, so tell us then what the bottom line is on the T-SPLOS that's coming up on the ballot in July. What's your bottom line takeaway that you want everybody to know?
I want everybody to know it is an unnecessary tax. Business Facilities, which is a company that rates states, cities, and counties, they, for the last 2 years, 2010 and 2011, have rated Georgia 7th in the nation in transportation infrastructure. So we're not going over a cliff. We're not collapsing. Our economy is the biggest problem. It is not transportation. The next big thing that people need to know is MARTA is 80% subsidized by taxpayers. Only 20% of MARTA's cost is paid for by fares.
MARTA is the train system that runs around Atlanta for those.
Right, it's public transportation. Now, here is a telling statistic that was put out in 2010, the same year that this law was passed. 82% of people in the Atlanta metro area drive alone to work. 7% telework, which means they stay at home and work like I do. 5% carpool. 3% ride the train. 2% ride the bus. So you got a total of 5% in the Atlanta area using public transportation, and that's where they want to invest their money. Cobb County, one of the biggest counties to the west of Atlanta, has passed a referendum not wanting MARTA in their county. So has Gwinnett County. Fayette County, just south of Atlanta, doesn't want them there. So these people, the county commissions and the people there, I've worked with them from all three of those counties. They understand public transportation, and they don't want it. There's not a public transportation system in America that's not subsidized. The national average is 59% subsidy. So what the chamber wants to build is a gigantic thing that we'll have to continue to feed for the rest of eternity. And that people need to vote against this tax. We need some sanity back into government and stop the special interest group from running our state. And that's what's going on right now.
All right. So, how can folks get in touch with you if they've got questions or if they want you to come speak to their civic group?
If they want to get information, go to valdostateaparty.com, and you can contact me on there. And I got five speaking engagements Saturday at that meeting, and a lot of my time is getting taken up. I have to work too. And but there's, if you're in the Atlanta area, there's some excellent groups up there. If you'll get in touch with me, I'll get you in touch with people up there who are fighting the SPLOST tax. And what has amazed me is there's people all over this state in the Tea Party movement that have raised up and are fighting this. And I think we got a good chance of beating it if we can get the public educated as to what's going on.
All right. Well, I appreciate you coming on the show. We've been talking with Nolan Cox. He's the president of Crown Chemicals out of Valdosta, Georgia. He's also the head of the Valdosta Tea Party and the chairman of the Lowndes County GOP. He's talking to us today about the upcoming T-SPLOST vote for transportation. It's 1% sales tax for transportation projects in the state of Georgia. And Nolan, thank you so much for coming on the show. We'd like to have you back on again.
Listen, I've got at least another hour of details I could give you, but you've got the big pieces, and it's, to me, it's so simple. We don't need regional government. We don't need a tax in a time of economic problems. We're leading the nation in Georgia in bank failures. And the economy is our biggest problem, and you never fix the economy with another tax. That's all you need to know.
I agree. Nolan, thanks so much for coming on the show, and we will have you back on again soon. All right.
Thank
We're
you,
Valerie. Nolan, all right. Have all right. a good day, Nolan.
All
We're
right.
going to let Nolan go. Come back to the Valerie Sergeant Martin Show.
You know the Constitution like the back of your hand. You've read books, listened to podcasts, attended lectures, surfed websites, and watched videos. You've made liberty your life's goal. But something seems to be missing.
Stickers from LibertyStickers.com. Exercise your freedom of speech with the world's most dangerous bumper stickers. That's LibertyStickers.com.
But wait, there's more. You can buy Liberty stickers wholesale. Get them for 99 cents each when you put 100 or more in your shopping cart in any combination. Sell them or give them away. They're great for gun shows, flea markets, fairs, outreach, and more. Earn extra money, promote freedom, and spread the word. Need custom stickers, labels, or decals for your organization or business? Liberty Stickers makes them. Go to LibertyStickers.com to order or call 877-873-9626. LibertyStickers.com, the world's most dangerous stickers.
What's up with these sorry politicians? Lots of art. When it's showtime, whimpering like little shih tzus. You want big cuts. Ron Paul's been screaming it for years. Budget crisis? No problem. Got $1 trillion year one. That's trillion with a T. Department of Education? Gone. Interior, Energy, HUD, Commerce? Gone. Later, bureaucrats. That's how Ron Paul rolls. Want to drain the swamp? Ron Paul. Do it.
I'm Ron Paul, and I approve this message.
This is Mercy. If you're listening to this message, warriors, you are the resistance. Warriors, you are not alone. There are pockets of resistance all around the planet. We are at the brink. Read about it in The Sovereign, newspaper of the resistance. Available now at newsstands everywhere. The Sovereign is a monthly 24-page tabloid newspaper featuring incendiary content about life during wartime in the age of Obama. Warriors, keep to date every month. Remember to read The Sovereign, newspaper of the resistance. Available at newsstands everywhere. This alert is for all you boppers out there in the big city, all you street people with an ear for the action. This is Mercy. If you're listening to this message, warriors, you are the resistance. This is Mercy. Mine will be the last voice you will ever hear. Don't be alarmed.
Hey, y'all. This is Ron with Ron's Media Matrix. Be sure to tune in to Ron's Media Matrix, brought to you by the Freedomizer Radio Network, every Tuesday from 10 a.m. to 12 p.m. Pacific Standard Time. My co-host and I will cover a range of interesting topics, including current events, along with special guest interviews with artists, journalists, filmmakers, and other folks involved in the emerging digital media and 21st century publishing venues. That's 10 a.m. to 12 p.m. every Tuesday. And if you want to be part of the show, the call-in number is 347-324-3704. Be sure to check out the new Freedomizer website at www.freedomizerradio.com.
Hi, folks. Joanne Moretti here, inviting you to tune in at 6 p.m. Eastern, that's 3 p.m. Pacific, Monday through Thursday, for Liberty Underground and Moretti Report, the best 6 o'clock news on the web. Please join me, as well as my great co-host JoJo Norton and our chat moderators Lynn and Anna, as we bring you the latest news, current events, analysis, and an occasional featured guest. That's 6 p.m. Eastern, Monday through Thursday, right here on Freedomizer Radio.
Hey, everybody. Welcome to the Valerie Sergeant Martin Show. I'm your host, Valerie. Got a great hour-long show for you this Thursday. So welcome. If you'd like to call in, our number is 347-324-3704. You can also join us at the freedomizerradio.com chat. We're going to have our guest today is Jason Spencer. He's representative of Georgia's House District 180. He's going to talk to us about the proposed 1% sales tax for transportation in Georgia, also known as T-SPLOST. We're going to talk about constitutional carry, Second Amendment issues here in the state of Georgia, and drug testing for welfare recipients. Those are all subjects that Representative Spencer wanted to discuss. So this should be a fun hour. We have on the line with us Representative Jason Spencer from Georgia's House District 180. Hi, Jason. How are you?
Hey, Valerie. Thanks for having me on tonight.
I'm glad to have you on the show. I am really excited about these topics you have proposed for us to discuss because they're very controversial. And, you know, I love controversy.
Well, you know, if you don't have controversy in your life, then it will be dull.
Well, all right. Well, let's let everybody else know what we're talking about here. In specific, you said you wanted to talk about T-SPLOS, the proposed 1% sales tax to go towards funding transportation here in the state of Georgia. And you didn't say in your email whether you were an opponent or proponent of T-SPLOS. So I'm going to give you an opportunity to tell me your thoughts on this T-SPLOS tax.
Well, this is a bill or a law that was put into, signed into law in 2010. It predated my election. I got election in November of 2010 and took office in 2011. But I'll tell you right off the bat, I am strongly opposed to this new tax. I do not think we need a new tax right now when Georgia's still in a recession and folks are still trying to come out of recession. I think the last thing Georgians need is a new tax to have to deal with. But what T-SPLOS is, it is, you know, it predated me, so I'm having to do a lot of research on how we came about this tax. But essentially, T-SPLOS was under House Bill 277 in 2010, essentially divides the state into 12 regions along the lines of our regional development centers in Georgia. It creates where the counties, I'm in Region 12, but my House district covers Region 12 and Region 11, so I'm having to look at the how T-SPLOS will affect Region 12 and also Region 11, so I'm having to do double duty on how this will affect Camden County, Ware County, and Charlton County down in far southeast Georgia. So, but that's what it is. It introduces a new tax for the funding of transportation projects, an infrastructure project in the state of Georgia. This is not a new tax on gas. Right now, Georgia has gas tax and to fund highway projects that is collected and goes to the Georgia Department of Transportation. But essentially, I believe this tax came about. Proponents will say that we need to relieve our congestion in Atlanta metro area, but someone down in southeast Georgia who we do have transportation needs, but they're much different than those of Metro Atlanta area. And I think a lot of the motivation for this legislation was to invest more in transit to relieve congestion. That's probably what a lot of most of your listeners probably hear about is relieving some of the congestion in Atlanta is sort of the impetus for this legislation. But Georgia collects taxes through an excise tax on gasoline per gallon at 7.5 cents. Then there's an additional Georgia sales tax per gallon at 14.5 cents to give us, and that's if you're assuming that the gallon per gas is at $3.62. That's sort of where we're at now. It's actually dropped a little bit recently, but and then you've got the additional tax on top of that, which is the federal gasoline tax at 18.4 percent. So you've got a total motor fuel tax per gallon in Georgia at about 40.4 cents. So per gallon. So this new T-SPLOS tax is not an additional tax on this gas tax that we currently pay. It actually will be a new tax on food. In Georgia, we don't have a sales tax on food. That went away when Governor Zell Mueller was in office. He put in legislation to gradually phase out the tax on food. But this would actually reimpose a 1% sales tax on food and, in some cases, some prescriptions that are not exempt. So right off the bat, I think it hurts families that are struggling a little bit. They're trying to pay the bills. I think it affects single mother families. I think it affects the elderly more. To finance infrastructure projects in Georgia, the thing with the gas tax, at least if you're using the roads and you're beating up the roads, you're paying for them. They call that a user fee in essence. And you know, that's if they're going to raise the tax, at least raise it on the gas. But people are struggling right now, and right now I don't think this is a time to do something like this. Second of all, I think there's a question of constitutionality with T-SPLOS. In T-SPLOS, what will happen is let's say in Region 12, for example, if the more populous counties end up passing or vote the tax in, then what happens is the counties that vote it down lose that right to vote that tax down, but they end up getting taxed anyway because they're in a region. Well, our Constitution, state Constitution, gives no authority to the state to create such a regional tax and to impose and create a sales tax to levy with counties in one region. They're defining this region as a special district. I believe there's some serious constitutional questions here. What is a special district? If you read our Constitution in the state of Georgia, the intent of what a special district is a county, not an aggregate or a region of counties to impose a tax. But the state has the ultimate power to tax, and we delegate what taxing authorities, special districts like counties, can do. So this could be seen as taxation without representation.
Right.
There is no accountability here when this tax is levied if it passes in whatever region. It's also been said that this could essentially be the largest tax increase in Georgia's history if all regions pass, to collect well over $18 billion over 10 years, because this is a 1 cent tax, or excuse me, 1% sales tax to be levied over a 10-year period. And as you know, with like local SPLOST, these taxes really never go away. They just constantly get renewed. I say that, and I'm not opposed to infrastructure financing when it's needed. I would like to see at least give the counties the ability to say, hey, if we want to do a regional project with, say, Camden County wants to do something with Charleston County to finish out a road, they should have an intergovernmental agreement to work beyond themselves to do that, instead of being forced in a situation where they may not be able to keep all the taxes collected. For example, one of the counties that I'll be representing in my new district is Ware County, which is Waycross. The entire list of projects there, the total cost of that list is about $84 million. But the what they call the constrained list, the funding that comes from this tax, will only be in the amount of about $39 million. But if Region 11, let's say, that, which is the southern region, if Region 11 votes this down, then what happens is the grant money that normally comes from Department of Transportation, they call it the LMIG grant, you get that 10%, then it increases up to 30%. We have to do a 10% match of whatever you get from that grant. But if you vote it down as a region, then now you have to do a 30% match. So you get penalized for voting down a tax in a situation where all the taxes collected within that one county over a 10-year period won't get 100% of that tax back. In the case of Camden County, all the taxes collected over a 10-year period, we're only going to get 30% of that tax money back. So we're considered
Who would you be subsidizing, since you only get 30% of your own tax dollars back? Who would get the 70% of your tax dollars?
Well, the way they got this worked out is it would go to counties with other higher project needs. The way it looks that I've looked at, the numbers that I've looked at, you'll get more money goes to Liberty County, for instance. They'll be getting a lot more of that tax money to them. In this case, in Region 11, some of that money is going to get shunted back to towards the Lowndes County, Valdosta area, in that area. So some counties that are poor will end up getting more of the money, but some of the counties that are wealthy will end up giving that money to the poor counties. It just depends. You have to actually look at what region your county's in and kind of determine how that money is going to get shunted. So this is, the proponents of this tax will say it's going to create jobs, it'll create infrastructure jobs, and it's going to lead to economic development. But I always say, in a time like this, we cannot tax ourselves into prosperity, like Winston Churchill has said. You just can't do it. It's like standing in a bucket. But as this, I'm opposed to T-SPLOS. I'm very concerned about the constitutional issues that surround this legislation. I believe there's probably going to be a court challenge to this. Even if your region votes it down and they penalize you, I think that in itself could be potentially unconstitutional. But I have talked to several constitutional attorneys that I have available to me, and I've had some opinions written to me about the uncertainty of such a tax, and that there's really no authority in our Constitution to impose such a regional tax like this. And you're going to create this regional bureaucracy that essentially decides to distribute this tax out. So it's a very complicated tax. I think voters should be aware of this when we go to the polls on July 31st to vote it up or down. But that's I did want to bring that up as a topic of conversation.
So it will be on the July 31st ballot statewide?
Statewide, yes. And whatever county you're in, you need to find out what region you're in. You can find that on the Georgia Department of Transportation website.
Okay. Let me ask you a couple of quick questions just to follow up. So this proposed tax is a 1% sales tax, and you said it is on food and some prescriptions, but it's not just on food and prescriptions. It's on what? Everything, right?
Yeah, all your purchases, but to
right,
include
every purchase.
Food, yeah, to you, yes,
right,
all your purchases
and where,
to include
why you,
food and.
Right, and you made the distinction because right now we don't have any taxes on food.
Well, just to let everyone know that it's not on necessarily on the users that may use the highways very, very a lot. If you're going to impose a tax, at least put it on the people who are using the roads.
And we already have, like you said, a 41 cents per gallon tax on gas. Here and how much does that tax generate for the Department of Transportation?
That's a good question. I'm actually having some research done on that right now. I was trying to get that number tonight. It's funny you asked that question.
I talked to Nolan Cox about it. He's from Lowndes County. He's a strong opponent against this new tax.
Yes,
and he said that this $18 billion over 10 years that this new T-SPLOST bill would raise is almost double what the current budget is. So it's like a 96% increase in the Department of Transportation's budget. How is that justifiable, first of all?
I don't know. The reason why I'm suspicious about this justification is Georgia Department of Transportation, and this is public record, you can go back and look at the last four audits, and they've not done so well on their audits. I mean, I read the latest audit, some sections of the latest audit, and it talks about how the accounting is done, how their accounting methods are done, and that it is open for fraud. So here we have a bloated, in my opinion, a bloated agency that needs to really clean their house up before they can come asking Georgians for more tax money to fund infrastructure projects. So that in itself concerns me greatly, and we don't need to create another regional government to levy a regional tax that's questionably unconstitutional because our Constitution doesn't actually have the authority to do such. So if they wanted to create a regional tax scheme like this, then the legal way to do this and the right way to do this is to amend Georgia's Constitution and then have it ratified by the voters if that's what they want to do. But I would like to see if counties want to do these type of regional projects, at least have the counties, give the counties the ability to enter in intergovernmental agreement and opt out if the agreement is not what they want to be a part of. So counties
can right now, I didn't mean to interrupt you, but I was just going to say, can right now your counties work together in conjunction with one another to complete road projects independent of the state?
I can't really honestly answer that question accurately, but I don't think so. I'll go on a limb and say I don't think so
because
the reason for this regional tax.
I think they have to get permission right now from the state before they can even work together jointly. So
I know under the Constitution the counties can go under intergovernment agreements to set ad valorem taxes or to impose ad valorem taxes. If like a company comes in and it's a company's in actually, let's say it's theoretically in four counties, then four counties could come to an intergovernmental agreement and impose a property tax on that business and to get, you know, the revenue that way. They are allowed to do that, only to levy property tax and come into an intergovernmental agreement. And that's allowed in the Constitution. Well, a similar situation in TSPLOST is they would allow counties to get together and to impose a regional tax, a sales tax, not a property tax, but a sales tax, but there is no authority in our Constitution to do that.
Right. Okay. All right. So, and the vote is July 31st statewide.
Right.
And you are suggesting that all of Georgia, all Georgians should vote against this when it comes
to... Yes, I think, yes, absolutely. I do oppose this. I think we need to go back to the drawing board and come up with a different way. And second of all, let's find out why the Georgia Department of Transportation is having such a problem with their last four audits. I think we need to investigate this as a legislature a little bit.
Double the budget to do more projects, I mean, you know, why would we give them more money when their current processes are in question or doubt?
Exactly.
Seems like a common sense
Absolutely
thing
agree.
Right there. Like you said, why do it now, given the current, I mean, they say that it's a jobs project, basically, is what they're saying.
Oh, sure. The proponents will tell you this is a jobs bill or a jobs, you know, things that will help economic development. I mean, those are the new buzzwords now. I tell people now, you know, I've only been in the legislature one term, and what I have found now in this kind of economy is we've always heard those, especially conservatives, we always hear those phrases, well, do it for the children, do, you know, pass this bill for the children. Now the new buzz phrase is do it for the job. And we have to be very careful about these buzzwords like stimulate the economy, do it for the jobs, economic development. We need to be concerned about those buzzwords because a lot of times when new things get brought to voters, like a new tax, they're going to use new buzzwords to sell that. And I think voters need to be keen and aware of these buzzwords and really study the issue before they cast a vote on that.
Right. Well, there's no – government doesn't have any money that it didn't take from somebody else in the private sector, you know. So any money that they get is money that is being pulled away from some other productive place.
Exactly.
I never understood that justification, you know. And if we're supposed to be a free market economy, you know, then we're not supposed to have government make work projects, no matter what.
Well – absolutely. I mean, you hit on a good point about essentially Keynesian economic philosophy. That's essentially what this is. It wants to extract the money from the economy and put it into infrastructure projects. You know, some of these project lists, I've talked to a few county commissioners, you know, in my new district, and one commissioner says, this is not a regional project. This is a local project that happened to be on this list. So, yes, it may be creating a job for a firm out there to create this new bridge that could really be considered a local project, not a regional project, that a local county could have financed themselves through their own SPLOST revenues. So it's things that you have to look at these lists and determine, well, is this truly a regional project, or is it something that could have been off the list and could have waited
locally
a while?
Right.
Yeah,
well, also,
so,
and then there would have been direct lines of accountability to your county leadership rather than some made up regional authority, and
right,
the people would have direct lines of access because they'd be voting for those people directly.
Right. Exactly. So there's no account. There really is no accountability for the voter. Who do we hold accountable if this tax passes in your respective region? And who do we hold accountable for that? The money, I'm told, when you read the TIA law, it's going to be directed by the Georgia Investment Finance Commission, regional, I guess it's called GFAC, GFIC. And this is appointed committee. It's actually a constitutional commission, a commission that's actually formed in our state constitution that is made up of several members, the Speaker of the House, Lieutenant Governor, you know, different other officials. and they sort of appoint a citizens panel to for oversight, but that wouldn't be my preference. Political appointees for oversight would not be my preference. My preference would be an elected body to that's accountable to the voter would be my preference. Because if they're going to levy a tax in a regional capacity, which I believe there's no authority in our Constitution, then at least have there needs to be some elected representation on there. So you've got to have – I think that flies in the face of American traditions of what our country was founded upon. I mean, we fought a revolution over taxation without representation.
Yeah. Well, okay, so – Jason Spencer says vote no on T-Splos for on July 31st.
And I tell you to also, you know, look at candidates who are running for office. And if they're opposing or supporting T-Splos, I mean, if you're someone
don't
who's of limited if you're of limited government mind and persuasion and less government and low taxes, you need to look at your candidates, whether they are Republicans or Democrats, because you have Republicans, supposedly, you know, small government Republicans, supporting this tax. So you really need to not look at the labels. You need to look at, as what I tell people, don't look at the label on the sleeve as always. You need to look under the hood about what's really there. So look at the candidates and ask them, where do you stand on this new tax? Where do you stand on T-Splos?
Now, do you have to run again this year? Are you subject to? Do you have to? Go ahead.
The term is every 2 years in the House of Representatives and the Georgia General Assembly, as in the Senate. So I am running in my new district. It's newly drawn into Ware County and Charlton County from Camden County, and I do have opposition in the Republican primary. And I will say my opponent did go on record supporting this new tax.
Okay. So how did redistricting affect you? Did you get like a hugely different district this go around?
Absolutely. I got an extremely different district here in Southeast Georgia. Most of my current district is essentially a coastal district. I live in a coastal community and we have coastal interests. But the new district now has moved in towards the interior part of Southeast Georgia, which is very rural. And where we're at, we've got a lot of swamp area, forestry area, and towards the adjacent counties that come next to Camden County. So I've been drawn into I call it a sister county, Charlton County. Actually, Charlton County was a part of Camden County years ago in the 1800s. That would be considered a community of interest, and we move all the way up into Ware County. So I'll be representing Charlton County and Waycross in the Okefenokee Swamp down here in Southeast Georgia.
I had a friend of mine, Tony McBrayer, who had his district dramatically changed this year, and Tony, because it was so different, he decided not to run. Did you ever have a thought that you might not run this go-around?
Well, I know Tony. We are freshmen. We came in together. He was in my suite. He was my suite mate.
Yeah, I would even go so far as to call you Tea Party candidates, both of you.
Yeah, we were. I mean, I'll be honest with you. We had backing, huge backing of the local Tea Parties here where I'm at, and he had a lot of backing from his local Tea Party in Tiff County.
Don't you think that had some that factored into your districts getting changed dramatically?
It's very, very likely. Very, very likely that was a possibility. When the district was my district was changed, I got paired up with Representative Mark Hatfield out of Waycross, Georgia. So I was already paired with another incumbent. So. And then a third individual decided to enter the race. So conceivably, until about a month ago or so, this was a three-way race in Southeast Georgia in the new 188th House District. Now that Mark Hatfield has decided not to run, statistically, our district is very heavily Republican, and most of the voters are in Camden County. It is sort of Camden County dominated still, which was a good thing for me because it favored my chances of winning. But Mark decided to run into the Senate race when Senator Greg Goggins decided not to seek re-election. So now that's down to a two-man race here in the new 180th district. And I do like my chances in this race. Now, Tony's district, he really took a hit in terms of losing most of his base of support. He had a lot of support in Tift County. I think he lost close to 80% of Tift County and got redrawn mostly into Colquitt County, and he didn't really know anybody in Colquitt County.
Right.
So I just received a phone call from Tony the morning he made his decision not to run before he went public. He said, "Before I go public, I wanted to personally call you and let you know that I've decided not to run, and it's been a pleasure serving with you." And I just, you know, encouraged him to, look at other options if God has those out there for him. But Tony's a good man of character. He's a strong Christian, and he said, "Well, God had to close this door, and there will be another opportunity, I'm sure." But Tony was a strong conservative.
Yeah, and that district, that area will miss his leadership because he's a really good guy. I don't want to get too sidetracked. I want to make sure we cover constitutional carry and drug testing for welfare recipients before we have to go, because we only got about 15 minutes here.
All right.
You introduced a bill to make let's talk about constitutional carry and what it is and your efforts towards getting that bill passed.
Well, constitutional carry basically affirms the fact that you don't need to ask government for permission to defend yourself and to exercise your Second Amendment right. In Georgia, we have to, if you want to do concealed carry, you've got to have a permit, meaning that you've got to ask government for permission to exercise your Second Amendment right. So if you have to ask for permission, then it's not a right, is it? And then second is, you've got to pay a gun, I call it a gun tax, to get this permit, and you're subjected to fingerprinting, and you're actually treated like a criminal in this process of trying to, as a law-abiding citizen, to go through the process of defending yourself. You already go through a background check. If you go buy a gun in a gun store, or at a show, you will have to purchase, you'll have to fill out a form for the FBI, and they do a background check. So there's one check right there. And then when you go in Georgia to carry your gun, you can only carry your gun in the car or in your place of business without a permit. You can't carry that on your person legally here in Georgia. So without a permit. So that's essentially what my bill did, was remove that barrier. And it was based on the premise that a law-abiding citizen should not have to ask the government to defend themselves. In Georgia, if you're a felony, if you're a felon, you can't own a gun. You can't do that. It's criminal. So in Georgia, that's what I wanted to do, was remove that barrier for law-abiding citizens. Because the truth of the matter is, criminals are not going to go through a permitting process. If they want to commit an act of crime with a weapon, they're probably going to steal their weapon from someone, which is a criminal act, and then do their criminal act with that weapon. So they're not going to go through the normal processes of doing that. A lot of the opposition to that is, well, this is going to turn Georgia into the Wild Wild West, and I don't agree with that. And the truth of the matter is, Wild Wild West was probably tamer than we think, because you had people who were armed. You had law-abiding citizens who were armed. Yes, you're going to have criminals out there that abuse that and commit acts of aggression against other people. But that was essentially intent behind my legislation. I put it through, and it got assigned to the Homeland Security and Public Safety Committee, and I did get a hearing. It did not come to a vote. I took a recommendation from Georgia Carey to sort of clean up the language.